share with the committee so they can get a full appreciation of the operating environment we find ourselves in, and certainly appreciate the risk of post-COVID that stands within municipalities. Because I think, as you would appreciate, the position we're in before COVID, you also understand that the COVID has added significant burden to municipalities, as now many of our residents are sitting at home. Industry
I'm sorry,
fully gotten up to speed.
My apologies, Komoso, my apologies. Can you switch on your
yes, sir. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I did check. Okay.
Whoever is on the stage speaking, please switch on your mic, your video as well.
As I switch on my video.
Yes, we want to see you.
My video is on, Chair.
Okay.
I don't know whether... Can you see me, Chair?
We can't see you. Lubabalo and the team, please help while he's continuing with the presentation so that we don't eat on our time. You can continue.
Okay, sir. Okay, Chair, without much further ado, I think I'll hand over to Komoso from SALGA to deal with the presentation, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Councillor Baloyi. Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee and colleagues. So most of you would not have met me. My name is Komoso Letsatsi. I'm the newly appointed Chief Officer for Municipal Finance and Fiscal Policy. So I'll strive to meet the timeline in terms of the presentation, so I'll rush very quickly. So if I'm going too quickly, kindly just go. In terms of the presentation around the key messaging really from SALGA is that the operating environment, as Councillor Baloyi has indicated, has completely changed. I hope members can actually see the presentation. Can you all see the presentation? Okay, so I'm on the layout.
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. So I'm on the layout page in terms of the different areas that we basically will be covering in the presentation. So I'll quickly move to the next slide. So in terms of the introduction, obviously with everything else that's happening around COVID-19, the operational landscape for local government has drastically changed in the past couple of weeks, which will then necessitate the revision even around the initial budget assumptions, basically that municipalities actually worked on. And we've also seen that the directives that have been issued to local government has actually added more pressure and burden in terms of the operational budget of local government. So we'll basically touch on that. And the other issue that we're raising is that this crisis has actually exposed a lot in terms of the funding model for local government as well, and our ability to actually respond quickly in terms of the additional burden that came with the responses or interventions regarding COVID-19, as well as the backlog that the sector has basically been dealing with in the past years. So if I have to move to the next slide, in terms of the constitutional functions, basically, so the first pie chart there that talks to the three spheres of government, where national and provincial government accounts for 40%, national, provincial government accounts for 14%, and local government accounts for 46% of those constitutional functions. But if you look at, and then you go further to actually look at the division of revenue bill allocation over the 3 years, national government is 48%, provincial government is 43%, and local government is basically 9%. That's actually telling that there's actually a misalignment in terms of the responsibility that is placed on local government as a sphere of government that faces service delivery and the allocations in terms of the division of revenue there. This slide basically we took out from the presentation that was actually made by AG, and it will be officially made or tabled basically around June. But also this slide actually goes to indicate the funding gap as well in the local government space, we know that, I mean, municipalities have been struggling to basically collect revenue on service charges and property rates and taxes. The debtors book is basically sitting at over 181 billion. And also the cash flow challenges that the municipalities that have been experiencing, hampering their ability to actually respond or paying their obligations and creditors basically in time. And I think I've also touched on the issue around the equitable share, and I'll show in subsequent slides that in terms of the studies that have been conducted by both FHC and SALGA around the costing model, there is underfunding in terms of the basic services. That is the amount that's been transferred to the local government sector vis-a-vis how much it actually costs to actually provide a basket of services basically to the household. We actually expecting that the revenue base will further be strained by the prevailing economic environment as a result of COVID-19 as well. So the outlook really does not look good for the sector across the board, basically. And most of the municipalities already are starting to actually feel it. And already we see from the various engagements that we've heard with the sector that to a large extent, even the big metros have seen almost a 30% drop month on month in terms of revenue collections because of what's happening currently. If I have to move to the next slide around local government equitable share, as an example to indicate the point that we basically make, is that the number that the cost factor that's being used on the electricity side is actually 93.56, when the actual cost is actually sitting at 144. So that results in almost for the top 20 municipalities that actually owe ESCOM, results in the shortfall from a funding point of view about 680 million. And this actually necessitates the submission that we're putting forward that 26 years later, we therefore required to actually re-look at the assumptions that were in the white paper in terms of local government financing, because there was a lot of reliance that was actually placed on the ability of the municipalities to actually generate own revenue and cover most of the operational expenditure. But what has happened in the past years, we've seen more municipalities actually moving into a financially distressed position. It has been exposed as well in the ability of the municipalities to be able to pay ESCOM and the inability of municipalities to be paid to collect from their households. So I think I've made this point in the last slide, so I'm not going to dwell on it, so I'll just move to the next slide. So this slide talks to the cost comparison and the 686 million that I actually alluded to in the previous slide. And also there's then the issue that, I mean, around local government, I mean, compared to the PFMA, if you look at the PFMA, the SOEs, they're actually differentiated and there's various categories. But the MFMA's approach is more of a one-size basically fits all. As much as some of the formulas in terms of the grant, there's a redistribution based on the intention, but we think there's more to be done because the various categories of the municipalities are actually very different in their makeup and also in the customer profile. And what we then also tend to see is that generally there's an economic downturn where then the fiscals also takes a knock in terms of tax collection. It therefore also impacts on the transfers that actually goes to local government. Then it becomes a double whammy, and especially for those municipalities that are heavily reliant on national transfers and their ability to basically provide services to the poor. So our submission here is that, I mean, the 257 municipalities are very diverse in their nature, their ability of raising revenue from property rates and taxes and service charges, and whereas rural municipalities are predominantly dependent on national transfers. So that's something we have to relook at in terms of how we ensure financial sustainability for the sector and also how the allocations are actually made to actually accommodate more the more vulnerable municipalities without sacrificing in the rest of the sector. the next slide basically talks to the formula on equitable share. So if you look at the various factors in terms of the formula, so you've got a component around basic services which accounts for 80% of the funds. And then the institutional component as well, and the community service component, and the revenue adjustment factor. And C is the correction and stabilization of the factor. So basically, on this one is more related to the last slide that we basically made, that there's more variables that will then need to basically consider to make sure that the allocation is actually much more equitable, basically in nature. And is at the back of the different types of municipalities and challenges that are basically faced by the various municipalities. So if I would quickly move into the next slide. So the shortcomings really, that municipalities may be grouped together, the single cost approach, but the context and circumstances of development services the municipalities differ on a differentiated method and resources to achieve the optimal outcome. So basically, this slide is I've made a lot of points in terms of the previous slides, in terms of the various components. So I'll move to the next slide. SALGA's key costing model features. So this is the work that SALGA basically done in terms of really looking at the equitable share approach, that a comprehensive municipal specific profiling is basically required to make sure that we achieve the principles around equitable allocation. The cost of municipal basic services can be moderated individually because it's basically differs, and also in terms of topology, and the ability to establish the cost of municipal services based on actual cost, benchmark cost, average cost, or some combination of both. And the model also allows for temporal arrangements, adjustments to variable-based database like population size and number of households. So if we have to look at the relevance around some of the assumptions in terms of the white paper, in terms of the financing of local government, I think we've made the point that the current equitable share formula, very loose assumption of cost of providing services, the one-size-fits-all approach does not work because that differs from municipality to municipality. And also one thing that actually came out is how ineffective our conditional grant system has been, and especially around COVID-19, and it's the agency and the agility and the flexibility around some of these conditional grants to empower municipalities to be able to respond to intervention in times of crisis. So it has left much to be desired, as there's been delays in terms of the funds actually reaching local government when there's activity that's already happening basically on the ground. And also the need to actually make the IGR process more effective in terms of the mandate, and we'll make the argument in the subsequent slides. The problem is further exacerbated by the influence of current state of the economy on normal citizens and the quantum municipal owned revenue thresholds and taxes as assumed in 1998 white paper are not close to being met by most municipalities. So household poverty rates as well, we've seen an increase in that, resulting in an increase in indigence, and therefore it's one of the arguments we're putting forward that necessitate us to actually re-look at the reality on the ground that's faced by the municipalities, and around also the issue around the customer profile, because most of the municipalities, and especially those heavily reliant on national transfers, the customer profile does that it doesn't allow them to actually migrate their position in terms of diversifying the revenue base, because generally most of the customers will then be indigent, and especially looking at the rate of unemployment in South Africa, and with COVID-19, we're expecting the situation to basically worsen. Furthermore, the issues around ESCOP, and it's also very important that we look at that in line with what's really happening with the ability for the municipalities to collect and how that gets compromised in terms of the genesis around the electricity supply industry, the role of ESCOM versus those of municipalities, that in areas where ESCOM supplies in a municipal jurisdiction, then the municipalities then don't have the electricity component to effect credit control, because it has been proven that electricity is a very effective instrument in terms of effecting credit control. Then that affects the ability for the municipality to actually address the debtors book. So I think I moved away from the slideshow sorry, current. Okay. And then there's also the issue around unfunded mandates, powers and functions. And it has also come out very clearly at this point in time where municipalities went and responded to the directives that were issued. And the two examples that I can give, Chair, in this particular regard is the issues around the homeless, the provision of homeless shelter and an identified quarantine site, and the issues around security. Because when communities are affected, they go to a municipal office. So the municipalities are the face of service delivery. So that pressure actually came through, which required municipalities to respond much faster than the disbursement of funds by other spheres of government. And in a whole lot of instances, some provincial departments are actually still sitting with the allocation and it doesn't see its way to the municipality, which exacerbates the issue around unfunded mandates. So in an event where the municipality actually plays an agency role through the province, we actually submitting that those fiscal instruments that have been identified for that for that particular role, it should then go directly to the municipalities. And the rest, you basically need to deal with it in terms of the reporting framework and the performance there. Similar way in which conditional grants for municipal-specific functions get allocated directly to local government, as opposed to those funds going to the province and then from the province basically to the municipality. So those delays do create cash flow and liquidity risk for municipalities in a whole lot of instances. So this slide is basically to show that local government bears significant responsibility of unfunded and underfunded mandates. And we want to see even more in this particular instance where how the whole intervention and directives have actually been dealt with by the different spheres of government. And that discussion really, it happens week in, week out. There's not even a solution at this point in time. But the least that has been left to government, to local government, to actually follow through on provincial government in making those transfers. And where there's agency roles and service level agreement, that should not necessarily be the case. The IGR process should actually work sufficiently that when monies are transferred from national coffers to provinces, the turnaround time in terms of how it gets to local government must actually be addressed. So there's a huge gap in that particular regard. So I'll basically move to the next slide. And basically this slide just shows the allocation over the medium term expenditure framework. And I have highlighted the issue around the municipalities in on the coal base of service delivery and the fact that the delays in funds actually reaching local government, where local government plays an agency role, compromises the financial viability of the municipality. And therefore, we submitting as far as that we need to revisit the existing powers and functions towards creating an ideal municipal functionality model after which funding should then basically follow. And it should not depend on another sphere of government basically sitting on the funds when they decide to basically disperse. It's actually not aligned with the cash flow requirement basically on the ground in terms of municipalities providing those services. So the NEC of SALGA then also resolved during this time around COVID-19 as well, that one thing that actually very came out and how the crisis actually, the pandemic rather, caught us napping, is how insufficient the disaster relief allocation is to municipalities. I think 354 million is actually a drop in an ocean. So we were never ready for a crisis of this sort. For 257 million, you don't even begin to cover the burden or the pressure for local government. So we need to review the allocations and the assumptions around things like disaster relief grants. So, and that's one instrument that is legislated that should have actually have assisted the liquidity pressures that municipalities have basically been experiencing for the past 6 weeks or so, trying to respond to the directives and the interventions that are being implemented on the ground. As far as the NEC then proposed an allocation, an equitable allocation approach over and above the consideration of the plans that the municipalities basically have responded, but I would have submitted to COFTA and NDMC. But our issue there is that the entire process was sort of fraught with red tape, and the speed at which allocations were made to municipalities still leaves a lot to be desired, and especially in a crisis like that. So a lot of our processes, they're so inflexible. So it's more like, you know, it's business as usual. So we don't have the flexibility to amend certain things to respond with the agility that is required in terms of a crisis. So eventually we agreed on a hybrid model where NDMC will then relook at the response plans, the disaster response plans, and also use the formula that SARGA would have through to ensure equitable allocation in that particular regard. But needless to say, NDMC has allocated around 200 million, but we still insist in that we really need to look at the agility and the agency of our processes in light of a crisis. And then we further went, made submission around the MEEG, the Urban Settlement Development Grant. So in principle, and circulars have basically been issued in that particular regard by National Treasury as well. So in principle, the other spheres of government, National Treasury, agree with the principles that have basically been submitted, and decisions have been made in that particular regard. But also we fall short in terms of how quickly decisions are basically made to local government to assist in that particular regard. So if I have to move to the next slide, you know, presuming what pre-protest funds and as well as disaster relief funds have been earmarked for, SARGA has identified potential for unfunded COVID-19 mandate for municipalities. So that issue still remains unresolved in terms of how we're going to deal with it. And the discussion is basically continuing, and especially around the expenditures that municipalities have already incurred using their internally generated funds, with the expectation that other spheres of government would actually meet the part of their obligation in terms of transferring those respective grants to actually assist local government. So the next slide, Chair, is basically just all the directives that have basically been issued. If you allow me, I could just quickly skip all of those and basically just go to the slide that says additional bearing for directives and impact of COVID-19 on local government. So basically, what does it mean, the additional bearing in terms of response to COVID-19? So what is really coming out from the municipalities that there's more frequent levels of service delivery. And an example to be made is chemical trailers. In this particular instance, were not provided for in budget in terms of the frequency for the service to be provided. So if you have more people basically staying at home, and the longer the lockdown actually continues, so it's additional pressure on municipalities. Additional allocations would have to be made. But this is also in light of the fact that already municipalities are taking a knock in terms of own revenue and revenue collection. So meaning that the ability to actually respond to increased service demand is actually further compromised. So we'll definitely have to relook at what grants are available for repurposing to actually assist the municipalities to provide quality basic services. And the issue around the homelessness, the reality is that most of the municipalities have already gone and responded. So the issue that is outside of their mandate, and they should actually see how they actually resolve that expenditure that has basically been incurred by insisting on the other spheres of government, like the province, the Department of Social Development, actually covering that particular aspect. The monitoring as well of social gatherings, more frequent environmental health inspection, and basically identifying and availing existing facilities for processing for the homeless and basically the food security aspect. So all of those things are actually adding more pressure on the budget for municipalities. We've touched on the economy and the outlook. We've seen a number of studies by the IMF, the credit rating agencies. In certain instances, there's expectations that the economic activity could actually basically drop to around -6%. And obviously, that would come with consequences for the sector and the financial sustainability of the sector. We're expecting that the indigent household drastically increase as well, as more people are indoors after the new normal, and also depending on how long this period basically lasts. And obviously, the longer the lockdown, the higher the impact for everybody else, and adverse impact for the economy as well as for the municipalities and households as well. Basically, the revenue collections as well, we're seeing a drop there. Although we do encourage municipalities to collect, but the reality of the matter is that the disposable income of households is going to be affected. And in any case, we're coming from a low base and a challenging space where the debtors book has just been growing. So we're expecting that situation to basically worsen. We then insist on us re-looking at the assumptions around the budget, what is practical against expenditure framework that is basically approved, and against the fiscal instruments that are actually available to see really they're really responsive in a crisis like this. And our submission is actually not responsive to actually deal with the crisis. So one point that I would actually would like to make is that in terms of the preliminary numbers that I've been submitted, is that it is projected that there will be a 5% drop in the payment of rates, and it will cost municipalities about 14 billion. But that work continues in terms of on a weekly basis, basically assessing what the impact would be on municipalities. And obviously the function of how long this period basically lasts. So the longer the period, then the higher the impact, and we'd expect the numbers to actually go up. So we've touched on this as well, Chair. So if I could just keep on this, because then it talks on the indigent management and the fact that we project that to actually grow. And I apologize for the alarm in the background. So as SAGA, we've acknowledged that the lockdown will continue to income levels, and then we've also taken out communications in terms of the disconnection of electricity and interruption of water consumption, where we encourage our members actually not to, as this will worsen the current COVID-19 induced crisis in terms of flattening the curve. Also, we acknowledge that revenue collection levels will significantly drop as I've basically indicated. Therefore, we recommend the following: that municipalities must introduce measures to collect as much revenue as possible under the circumstances, as much as we recognize that it will be very difficult, but that revenue that can be collected should be collected. And that's the message that we need to put through. The issue around suspending of electricity, we're also encouraging that if in the same vein where we say municipality can disconnect water, electricity, as it will affect the ability to actually flatten the curve, we're also submitting that ESCOM should also not suspend electricity to municipalities. So as much as we acknowledge that the amount of transfers to local government have been growing, we come from a low base, and I actually against the obligations that are actually placed on the municipal sector. There's a need for radical review of allocation to the 3 tiers of government, and consideration should be made to transfer provincial grants directly to municipalities. And obviously, there's definitely a need to review the assumptions in terms of the white paper on funding local government. And the impact of COVID-19 will be long-lasting, and therefore, the Division of Revenue Bill must start addressing this particular fact. If budget assumptions are actually not reviewed, we're then expecting a serious shortfall and massive delays in projects which require reprioritization. And funding allocations and use of conditional grants should then be reprioritized. And I think that principle has just basically been agreed. The financial sustainability risk of local government continue to increase, and the provision of basic services. So our recommendations, that in the short term, Division of Revenue Bill should ensure that in cases where functions are delegated, assigned to municipalities, funding for those functions must be appropriated directly to those municipalities. The equitable share formula to portray realistic cost differences in municipalities. And I think this has also come out in terms of the work that was done on the IMTT for electricity, that the tariffs that are actually eventually approved for the municipalities are actually not cost reflective, and that probably goes for all other services. And also that SALGA proposes that the 20 billion distribution should be equitable and agile in responding to the agency. So the sector is generally extremely unhappy with the communication from National Treasury that funds will only be available in July in the new financial year, July, August rather, when the liquidity requirements, or rather the cash flow requirement, is basically immediate, as municipalities are actually not looking and they continue to respond to the interventions in terms of the directive issued. Considerations must also be made to make the grant framework to be more flexible to be able to respond in times of emergency. In terms of the medium term, SALGA has for a considerable amount of time lobbied for processes of review of division of revenue between three spheres of government. A lot of work has basically been done going back to 2012 between SALGA and FFC, and basically that continues. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the budget forum, Lokhotla, and we will make the submissions basically in those forums as well. And basically, the policy changes to be discussed at the budget Lokhotla should leave all stakeholders in a better position to come up with more equitable division of revenue for 2021 going forward. So, Chairperson, that's the submission from SALGA. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Somebody's mic is on. Can you switch on off your mic? Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation, and I hope members were listening and they have identified issues that they want to raise or to clarify, seek clarity on. The team behind the scenes, Lubabalo and Estelle, can you indicate who have shown an interest to engage on the presentation? No screaming, no screaming. I have requested that we must use the message icon. Anyone from...
Chairperson, sorry, it's in his right eye. I see that the chat has been disabled for me, so I can't use the message icon, unfortunately. But I would like to be noted for questions.
Okay, yeah, it was difficult. Okay.
I also don't have a button.
Honorable Titoit, Honorable Ryder, Honorable Njantu. Who else? We will see as time goes on. The first person that I'm going to allow to speak on here, who will also assist us in terms of time. I know you are good in managing time. Honorable Stuart, can you come in? Honorable Fanny Stuart? Honorable Fanny Stuart? Still struggling. Can I hand over to Honorable Ryder while he's still struggling to get in?
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm also struggling, so you'll see I'm out in my garden due to connectivity issues. If I may start, first of all, by acknowledging my former boss, and welcoming to our meeting and thanking him for his inputs. Chair, I'm going to start with three comments. So what is a comment and two are questions? First of all, you know, noting the correction, I want to state clearly that I think that the current less than 9% allocation to local government is hopelessly inadequate and does need to be reviewed. So I'm in full support of SALGA's position on that. However, the fact is that throwing good money into bad municipalities is certainly not desirable, and we do not want to see Treasury, throwing money away. So therefore, I also want to suggest that the formula for allocation of funds needs to be adjusted somewhat to take into account the historical governance and performance of municipalities. there must be an incentive to perform well in this space. You know, unqualified audits, clean audits, these should get rewarded, and disclaimers should get a base value. You know, like as in the bare minimum. Municipalities that are putting in effort in non-revenue water, electricity losses, and ensuring that their collection rates are maximized should be rewarded accordingly, and more funding should be given there. So I'd like to perhaps hear from both Selga and Treasury their feelings on that. The second point, Chairperson, the impact of COVID is massive, and certainly in financial terms, and I think collection rates have dropped substantially for municipalities. I know that margins on electricity are usually weighted quite heavily on commercial and industrial uses. These have been impacted during the lockdown as businesses have been shut down. Also, rates collections are impacted by reduced payment capacities of people who are not earning salaries, who are not getting income. So just in terms of that, I'd like to hear from Selga how they see them going forward. And understanding, you know, there's no one bullet solution to all of the issues, but you know, would Selga like to see a bigger allocation to equitable share, more conditional grants? How do they see the need for funding going forward to cover the gaps that are going to be caused by COVID? My third question really goes to Treasury, and you know, perhaps I can get Selga's inputs on this as well, specifically, because now I know that business plans have been submitted, and there have been seemingly paltry allocations. So, for example, I saw some figures yesterday where a 42 million rand business plan was submitted and only 600,000 rand has been allocated. So my questions are, and Selga, if you can answer, that'll be marvelous. Otherwise, hopefully Treasury can give us some insights. Is there more coming? In terms of these allocations, when will that happen? How are the business plans evaluated, and what criteria are used for allocation calculations? Because from 42 million down to 600,000 doesn't really make a lot of sense. Chair, I have other questions. I think it was a good presentation, and I want to appreciate that from Selga. But given the time, I will leave it at that. Thank you very much.
No, go on, Honorable Ryder. Honorable Ryder. Can come with those questions.
Okay, Chair, then the next question that I have specifically relates to disaster management being a district competency, and the fact that, you know, with the district model going forward as well, there's going to be increased reliance placed on districts. However, the question is, I know that many districts don't have capacity to deal with issues like this, both in terms of resources, human, and actual, you know, physical resources. But I'd just like to hear from Selga how the rollout has been happening. I know one size does not fit all. Districts in Gauteng are very different from districts in the Eastern Cape, for example. But perhaps an indication as to how that financial allocation has been rolled out and how it's been working. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honorable
Doit,
are you back?
Yes, Chair. Thank you so much. I apologize for the glitch there. Chair, a few questions. We must keep in mind that Minister Sisulu, the new Minister Sisulu, mentioned that the blocking and unblocking will also take place. So evidently, the burden of municipalities will become a lot larger than it currently is. Now, Selga indicated in the presentation that up to 30% less was received on municipal service accounts now, and a 5% drop in the payment of rates is expected. We must keep in mind that we're going to experience an increase in unemployment. It's currently taking place. Increase in indigent registration will put a larger burden on the municipalities. A decrease in the division of revenue after the amended budget. And this is the issue the issue currently is that municipalities can spend up to 75% of those allocated grants at this stage. Now, those grants were determined on the February budget. Obviously, those figures won't be applicable anymore since the income will not be the same. My fear is that overspending will take place in the meantime. because of the fact that up to 75% can be spent. SALGA indicated that the division of revenue must be paid directly to municipalities. I understand the frustration that there currently is, but my issue is that we've got so many municipalities that are currently under administration with questionable budgets. My fear is that the money won't necessarily go where it's needed. And it seems as if, in spite of the fact that there's a huge need outside for service delivery and for infrastructure to be put in place, that municipalities that failed to do so over the past 26 years are trying to put that in place during this COVID section. And that is not viable. There won't be sufficient funds for that. And I think under the current COVID regulations, the possibility of funds being misused and mismanaged is just too high. If you look back at the track record of municipalities, it's really a scary sight to see. That's all from me at this stage. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Strait. Honourable Ntandi.
Thank you very much. Good morning, members. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, my question will be following very closely the presentation, and also want to welcome the presentation from SALGA, which is very, very informative in terms of speaking to the bread and butter issues of the municipalities, also understanding that the municipality is in the cold face of the society. Chair, my question to SALGA, in terms of the recommendations that SALGA is making, did SALGA consider in terms of the capacity of municipalities? Because you have a huge challenge in terms of capacity in municipalities in terms of managing this funding, and also looking in terms of the audit outcomes that we had in the previous year, and also funds which was not spent, and also a risk plan. Did SALGA consider those aspects in terms of looking at the presentation that SALGA has made? So, but the presentation is very clear. And also, just the last question, Chair, is on what is SALGA's view around the unequal allocation around national, province, and local? What is the specific view of SALGA around that? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Njandu. Honourable Karim. Honourable Eunice Karim.
Sorry, thank you very much. Firstly, I just wanted to ask, I didn't get a good enough sense of how Treasury is allocating further funding, taking into account COVID-19, based on the specific incidents of the COVID-19 outbreak in municipalities, as it's planning to give more and more money with the supplementary budget. Can SALGA guide us on that? And can Treasury help? Have they got the information, the necessary information, to say, look, in these municipalities, the incidence is high, and therefore, we need to allocate more money and so on. So we're having a differentiated approach with these levels. And presumably that must take into account how much is allocated where. Secondly, maybe it's just me, and maybe I've got it wrong, but it seems to me that at least the first half of SALGA's presentation is based on more structural issues, more long-term issues. Now, given that we've got COVID-19, yes, this budget was decided on before COVID hit us, so February 2020 budget, but given that a supplementary budget's looming, and given that right now, looking at the current budget that's existing, we have to take into account COVID-19 issues, it's not clear to me what exactly, maybe it's there in different parts of the submission, but it's not clear to me precisely what exactly are SALGA's positions on more immediate issues that we can address and more long-term issues. In other words, a lot of the first half of the submission we've been hearing in different forms for a very long time. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. It's national parliament and national government that needs to pay more heed to what SALGA says. But we are where we are. And in short, I don't get a keen enough sense of what the overall strategy of SALGA is. What what's something that they think is doable in the short term, taking into account COVID hitting us right now, and hit us even further over the next 3 months, and what's medium term and what's long term. I'm not sure that I'm being very clear, Chairperson, but I'll leave that with you, to Malava. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Karen. You were very audible, and but I think overall today we are struggling, all of us, in terms of the signal. We couldn't see the presentation throughout, but we had to use what we received last night. And my questions, Honorable Members and colleagues from SALGA, will be based on what we have received, because I couldn't see if there are amendments that we have done. I might be in a disadvantaged position. Having suggested that the resources for the local government have fallen below the demand for services and infrastructure, currently local government receives 9% of the national fiscals. How much would you suggest the allocation be from the 9%, given the fact that the local government is responsible for 46% of the constitutional functions, and now there is COVID-19 pandemic, which all of us were talking about it, and we think something needs to be done, something we need to do things differently, and also acknowledging that the economy is not doing well, it's worse than what it was before the COVID-19 came. My next question would be that you also spoke about the 59% of the municipalities' debt, which is more, which is non-recoverable. You can't recover it. And my question is why? Why can't you recover those debts from the municipalities? Are there no proper debt recovery plans being put in place by municipalities? Or is it due to non-paying clients, due to unemployment? Whatever the reason or the factor might be, what I want to understand is, are you saying you are going to write off the debts? What plans do you have as the as local government? My apologies, Chair. Chairperson. Oh, I'm the Chairperson, by the way. My apologies. With honorable members, with the respect to the issues of unfunded mandates, the 2020 budget review, which was published by the National Treasury, beginning of this year, that's in February, indicates that some work is being done to address the question of unfunded and underfunded money. What is the view of SALGA in this regard? Are there any positive gains from the work, or things are still the same as before? If any, on the powers and functions or unfunded mandates of COVID-19, specifically on the relief fund application, SALGA makes an assertion that its model for MIG and urban settlement development grant was not considered based on project plan submission by municipalities. What does this mean, and whether there is any reason for it not being considered? While honorable members, I agree with most of the proposals made by SALGA for municipalities to effectively implement the regulations and directives of COVID-19. I personally do not agree with the exemption of municipalities from MFMA. As this is open, will be open for floods or for corruption and looting of state resources. We can't allow the state to adhere or to be responding in a lawlessness approach. Rather put certain measures in place to further strengthen financial controls, and I'm sure MFMA does accommodate such possibilities. So on that issue, anything that will allow corruption to raise its head, ugly head, I do not agree with it. Everything that we need to do, it needs to be done by the book. And Chair, lastly, the committee can also ascertain whether adequate and proper planning has been done for the proposed 20 billion for the COVID-19, so that there is no wasteful and fruitless expenditures shared by municipalities. We know what the status of the report, you have spoken to it. It's also on the slide, the status of the report issued by the AG in the sphere of local government, and we need to respond to those issues and try to have mitigating plans and have plans also to avoid, prevent, so that we don't react or try to respond to the issues at the end of the financial year, which means we will not be doing our work as public reps in terms of oversight. Anyone else from the members? Estelle? No one? Before I hand over to
Father. Chairperson, no, we've got no other
Chairperson, can I indicate, Chair?
Who's that?
This is Zolani Mkiva.
Mkiva, I will pardon you because I know you were not part of the process. You can speak. We don't scream for the attention of the Chairperson. Siyabonga, Kumkani. You can come in.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will be very precise and short. I would like to appreciate first and foremost the presentation by SALGA. I just wanted to check, Chair, if SALGA does consider the nature of the rural municipalities and the fact that the majority of people in those areas reside in rural areas. You know that they are rural towns, so they are towns. They are town centers, but there are people who live in the periphery of those communities, like rural areas. In the rural areas, this is what manifests greatly, particularly during this time of the outbreak of the COVID-19. That in those communities, much as we say people must do everything where they are, they must buy from there and so on and so forth, they don't have access to cash. In order for them to access cash, they have to go to the town centers, which creates a very big problem in terms of overcrowding currently at a period when we have to exercise social distancing. So I wanted to check, and they have to spend a lot of money in terms of transport. If you want 100 rand, you have to spend 30 rand to go and access 100 rand in town, which means you lose the 30 rand, you come back with 70 rand if that was your balance. So I wanted to check if SALGA and Treasury, can they consider more than just the equitable share, which is a general thing, some kind of a rural grant, which would allow subsidy for transport, things like that, because I think that the pressure which the rural communities get is much more than people who have access to transport. They have to pay more, who have access to ATMs and so on. So ATMs, pharmacies, everything is concentrated in towns, and the rural people have to pay extra. So I just want to check a possibility of a rural grant given in these circumstances. And even going forward, not only during this period of the COVID, can we begin to have a relook? Otherwise, we will forever be looking at rural communities as dead economies. Can't we have a way of replenishing and consider the fact that people in rural areas don't have access to these things, even for Treasury, maybe to encourage the bank to now consider the issue of making ATMs available in rural areas, especially the areas of convergence in those rural areas. It's ridiculous that everything is still in the cities and towns. Thank you, Chairperson. So the point that I'm really making is a consideration of a rural grant over and above the equitable share. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Eunice, you said you have left something that you want to add in your questions.
Thank you. That was an earlier request, but since you've got to me, very briefly, it's a more question for National Treasury, but Selga might want to respond. You see, normally it can't give money to local government, more money, because A, local government hasn't effectively and productively used the money allocated to it, and secondly, doesn't have the capacity to productively use more money. And we've argued for a long time that you don't just give money, you also assist with capacity. Now, the state is strained. At national and provincial level, it's not as if we have enough capacity either. But is National Treasury able to assist by even the provincial treasuries, those municipalities that need to address these challenges but don't have the capacity to do so?
Thank you very much, Honorable Karim. Can I now hand over to Salga and Treasure? Treasure, I think you are here already. Welcome. Can I hand over to both of you to respond to our questions, assist us to understand in terms of our clarity-seeking questions? Thank you. Salga?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, am I audible enough?
You are soft. I can hear you, but you soft. Your voice is soft.
Okay, Chair. I'll speak a bit louder. Am I very audible now?
You are. Other members, can you hear him?
Yes, coming through clearly.
Okay,
yes, Chair.
Thank you. Continue.
Okay, thank you, Chair, for the engagement from the members of the committee. Chair, I'll try and respond, and I know that those that I don't respond to, that members of the SALGA team who are part of the video conference will also assist in their responses. Chair, we'll start with the questions made by Honorable Ryder. I think we're in agreement with him that the allocation to local government is not sufficient. And he also made the point that there's issue about throwing good money after bad money, and also that there should be some reward and some punitive measures in the grant allocation, and those that reward good governance. I think, Chair, the problem with that approach is that you don't, it's not about the punitive measures to management of municipalities or leadership, but equally it's also punitive measures to communities directly. So I think we must bear in mind that measures that reward and also introduce an element of punitive measures deeply affect communities where they are. And I think we should find a better way of ensuring that those who need the most the help are actually given that help. But Chair, there's also the underlying point that many of us refer to, which is the issue around the lack of capacity or perceived lack of capacity and the issue of corruption, Chair, in local municipalities. And I think, Chair, we on this part, we've been very clear about
our position in that and condemning that. And also, Chair, we, I think it's important that we call for partnership with all political parties involved, because remember, the members that ultimately become councillors, members of SALGA, ultimately come from their political parties through whatever process. And we need to tighten or lobby people in those processes to ensure that we prevent criminals from coming into the local government sphere, because that's the source of it, and it manifests within local municipalities in various ways that we that we've seen across, Chair. But I think it's important that we also appreciate the source of many of these, that the people that we get as SALGA, as municipalities, we don't have a direct control, but rather the direct control is from the political parties themselves, Chair. Chair, the other point to make is that the how do we see it going forward, and how do we respond to the COVID issues? I think the question was asked more than once in different ways. Is the fact that the current reality is that industry has slowed down significantly, which is the biggest contributor or user of electricity, which in the main, the nature of the tariff is used to cross-subsidize households. And now with industry not being really dominant and not taking up the capacity we have, households are taking up that capacity. And households, our ability to collect in households has diminished significantly, or more so with the current challenges of the economy that we're going to face, and even beyond the COVID period currently now. So I think, Chair, the 20 billion rands that the head of state announced needs to deeply reflect on the issue of trading services, and not more on the on the grant side, but more so to deal with the operational challenges that municipalities will deal with. So I think the equitable share, obviously we make the point that the equitable share is not cost reflective to the services, but more so now, the 20 billion needs to speak more to the operational challenges, which will result in a reduction of revenue for municipalities, Chair. Chair, we don't know what approach was used to allocate the disaster relief funds, even though SALGA did make a presentation. And that presentation in the main, Chair, was informed by the following principles, that there are municipalities in the country that are not water authorities, that are not electricity authorities as well. So their revenue is far more diminished than many others. So we said prioritize those municipalities first in the allocation for the 300 million rand that was there. And then we also, through engagement with the Treasury and the cooperative governance, when we're reflecting on the projections for the spending of MIG and USDG, and said there will be some saving within the USDG grant, which is totally, I think, about 3 billion rand or 4 billion rand, as we saw at that point, and recommended that rather than use that 4 billion rand there to augment on the other municipalities that are water services authorities and electricity authorities as well, and then later your metros, that would have created a bigger pool for emergency disaster relief as opposed to what we've received now. And we saw that in the applications, I think the municipality in the Northern Cape has received 21,000, others 30,000 rands to deal with the immediate disaster relief challenges, which is not just insufficient, but deeply, put the municipality in a great situation, and how is it able to respond to COVID challenges. So that's the other response, Chair. The issue made by Honorable de Toit, I think, is very true, Chair, that Minister Sisulu has made various remarks about the continuation of blocking and re-blocking in communities, meaning to de-densify informal settlements. This is a few challenges, Chair. One is that normally in this process, Chair, there's a special configuration process led by municipalities, and now it seems to be led by the Department of Water and Sanitation. So again, who's the authority in that space? And Chair, when you start to re-densify and re-block, you're also increasing your provision of water and electricity and to areas which generally rely on the DORA allocation, where our ability to recover, in fact, it's zero. In most areas, in informal areas where we provide services, Chair, we don't collect anything as a municipality and rely on the cross-subsidization from other trading services. So as we do this in an increased pace, which is not reflective to the economic growth of municipalities or their growth of revenue, we're also adding more burden on municipalities that beyond COVID we need to deal with, and the burden will just be left to municipalities to deal with, Chair. So I think that will also significantly put a dent on municipalities. And I think it's well accepted now that the fiscus of the municipalities will be severely affected in that case. Chair, did we consider the capacity of municipalities and funds unspent and spent and the risk of those? I think there has been much consideration of these. But Chair, what must also appreciate is that as we do so, the burden on municipalities does not stop. It increases, and more so in the situation we find ourselves with increasing directive to municipalities with significant implications to municipalities' revenue, and also adding more functions to municipalities to do things that ordinarily is not part of its mandate. I mean, issues such as your social distancing and various others directly linked to COVID-19, Chair, where municipalities have had to be agile. As we are engaging, we're also incurring the cost, and now the cost has increased, I mean, we've incurred, when with the hope of getting that repaid through the disaster grant has not happened. So now we really dip into our own resource on revenue base to respond to COVID, and then equally the trading services is expectation to continue with the provision of water and electricity. Meanwhile, those two bills are increasing, and in the meantime, Eskom or Rainwater have not pronounced about how they're going to assist municipalities, because we're all in this together, Chair. So I think Homoto will speak a bit more detail about the nature of the submissions we made in relation to the allocation of the grants, not the grant rather, but the disaster one that I've just alluded to, but she can speak a bit more detail to that portion, including our submission about the 20 million rands, which I've also alluded to. And I think Honorable Karim was correct about that in our submission, we've dealt a lot with the structural issues, but equally with the structural issues that we've been raising for some time, as we've also dealt with sufficiently, Chair, with, and I think in the latter part of the submission, the short to medium interventions that we have put on there. But I do take note that the presentation may have not been sufficiently seen, or the one that we have maybe may have been an update for the past. We also can just touch base on that, Chair. Chair, on some of your the comments that you made, you asked the question, Chair, correctly, so that if you are saying 9% is not adequate for allocation to municipalities, what do you increase it to? I think, Chair, that requires a scientific basis, and we are saying as a point of departure, it's not cost reflective to the services that we are delivering to communities. So it must really be cost reflective of this as one of the bases that needs to be built into a financial model so we can deal with that. Because when we move from the 9%, Chair, we're already operating from a deficit as a municipality. Chair, the 59% municipal debt, which is not recoverable, is and which will grow, Chair, because we've also suspended our debt collection now to assist, so we don't implement debt, which will act counterproductive to our residents in lockdown and residents being at home. That will significantly increase. Chair, a number of that is also due to historic debt, but equally, Chair, debt that we'll probably prescribe. And equally, Chair, it's also related to the unemployment situation in our country, Chair. And more households, Chair, are becoming unable to service their municipal debt. So we can get into various initiatives such as reduction of water, getting prepaid meters to save, to protect the revenue source of municipalities. But Chair, remember, we at local municipalities, what you see is a direct reflection of what is happening in the country, but at a much more localized level, Chair. Chair, you also dealt with issues about the funded and unfunded mandate. I think Homoto will also deal with those responses, Chair. And then there was an issue that you raised regarding the MFMA exemption relating to COVID-19. In my understanding, Chair, I think that specific portion of the MFMA exemption dealt specifically and only with the process of approving your draft budget or taking your draft budget, then doing public engagement on your draft budget, and after then finalizing your draft budget, because the legislation is quite clear and instructive about when it must be done and how it must be done and by when it must be concluded. So COVID interrupted all of that because a bigger portion of that is public engagements and informing your public about what you're planning to do, and also the firing of council meetings. So that specific part of the MFMA exemption chair was a direct consequence of COVID-19 and the activities that were not allowed to do by as a consequence of the directive by the president, and also the national disaster, putting limitations on groupings of people, the number, and how you can do so. So that portion chair did not relate to other parts of the MFMA, but specifically towards the budget adoption process of the MFMA. Chair, the last question asked by the honourable member dealt with the challenge of rural municipalities and requesting if it's possible to have a subsidy of a grant that could assist our rural people that move around. I think it's important to appreciate the challenges faced by rural communities, and also I think when Komoto responds to the technical questions, he also add how we felt that rural municipalities in nature must benefit to what extent, and also appreciating that some municipalities have a greater resource pool than others, and we respond, we must try and factor in those who have very little to ensure that we are support, they get the bigger part of the support compared to those who've got a stronger and better resource base. So it would be very difficult to do so currently under the circumstances, more so understanding that the transport in rural communities and also our inability to perform in some of our basic functions. So it will be very difficult to respond in this case. It would be better assisted if national government and probably Treasury would come to the party in this case and then consider this. Yeah, I think from my responses, I'll pause there and allow the team, I think in the main, for Komoso to respond to some of the technical questions that they raised about the SAUDA presentation. Thank you, Chair Komoso. I think we can respond to this.
Thank you, Komoso.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Okay. Am I audible, Chair? I'm back on.
Yes, you are.
Am I audible? Yes, okay. Thank you. Just quickly going to the question. And thank you, Councillor Balwe, for covering most of the questions. There's a question that actually came around the disaster relief fund and how insufficient it was. And I think it's a submission. $2 million business plan submission vis-a-vis the 600,000. Those are a function of the overall budget allocation in terms of that particular grant. And that's the submission that we've made on behalf of the sector, both to COGTA and to National Treasury, in terms of how it's insufficient. And unfortunately, a lot of the budget allocation is a function of the overall pool and is always not reflective on the demand on the sector, basically on the ground. And that's the biggest driver. And from where we're sitting, there's no clear indication if there'll be additional funds allocated for the disaster relief. However, what National Treasury has done, and our colleagues from National Treasury are actually on the call and can actually respond to some of these questions, is that the sector has been allowed to repurpose and redirect some of the grant to actually assist in basically responding to the demand on the ground. And the submission that we made at SALGA, we relooked at the allocation approach and made a submission and a proposal where the basis was the original equitable share formula. Then we added the redistribution factor that would take into consideration the financial standing of the different municipalities, as well as the issue around the capacity in that municipality, the status of the infrastructure, as well as you would have seen that specifically on the water side, there were water tankers that actually had to be dispersed due to the infrastructure backlog in most of the rural municipalities as well, to basically contain the spread of the virus. And those principles were actually accepted by the technical team. And in terms of the feedback that we've actually gotten from a progress point of view from the department, this is COGTA in this instance, is that the principles that SALGA submitted around the allocation over and above the plans have basically been taken into consideration to actually allocate the 354 million basically to the sector. And maybe what we need to do with that specific question, Chair, if you allow, if I could make a submission, that the actual numbers and how much was allocated to which municipality, and what were the final considerations over and above the formula that was then submitted, then we can come back with the actual numbers in that particular regard. So that's a submission that I'll then make. And then the next one was more around what are the immediate proposals that SALGA is basically making. And so I would make a submission that, I mean, we basically presented in the slide, but one of the things that we actually requested the various spheres is to make sure that the funds that are basically due to municipalities must actually be dispersed to reflect the crisis that we're dealing with as a country, and especially the pressure on local government. There's been much to be desired in that particular regard in terms of the speed, and that's what we've been pushing for SALGA in terms of the allocation and the disbursement to municipalities immediately to actually assist the municipalities in the 3 months to the financial year, because the financial year end is basically in June. And if that does not happen, obviously then it increases the risk of the most of the municipalities actually closing in overdraft in terms of the expenditure that has basically happened. And the 20 billion as well, the submission that we're making is to avail the cash flow to the sector to actually cover some of that expenditure, which is the immediate for the 3 months. Unfortunately, there's no buy-in in that particular regard, because the budget planning is a highly regulated process, and the submission from National Treasury is that it has to be promulgated in the adjustment budget. But for medium term to long term, there is no doubt that as much as submissions have been made previously, there's been very little changes that have basically been made. And hence, that's why we're making that submission, that it's urgent now more than ever that we relook at the funding model of local government if we're going to empower local government to be able to respond and provide basic services as is intended, basically in the constitution as well. And to address also a lot of the structural issues that have been presented specifically over the years. And that work is basically continuing between SALGA and the FSC as we speak right now, and basically together with the sector. And once it's finalized, then we'll then make a presentation in terms of what that actually means. And then around the 20 billion allocation, and I would like National Treasury to actually respond in that particular regard. But I think the president was very specific in terms of the areas that are actually targeted around the 20 billion, which is the issue around the homeless the shelter, the sanitization, and as well as the issue around basically food puzzles. But one thing that National Treasury had actually even indicated as early as last Friday, and the discussion is basically continuing today as well, is that partly the 20 billion would not go towards actually covering the municipalities in terms of the revenue shortfall and the expectation. So there's a misalignment there in terms of the expectation, because there will be shortfall in terms of the revenue available to allow the municipality to be able to respond to the intervention, and to the extent to which the allocation would not be covered, the expenditure basically on the ground. So is that alignment that's basically required, and the discussion is basically happening. But one thing that is very clear that was communicated is that money is basically not coming basically before June. So that process that's actually working for. And then in terms of the unfunded mandate, basically, and the reason why we made the submission is that there's still challenges there around the IGR and how the flow of funds has actually happened, basically, and the speed at which it basically gets to local government. And we've got different structures at a technical level where we engage on these issues, basically on a weekly basis. And the issue around the unfunded mandate and the gap there, and the fact that some of the grants are basically either sitting in provincial at this point in time or at national level, and they're not getting to local government as quick as they should, is something that we actually pursue to make sure that by financial year end, then we don't end up with huge problems and audit issues and adverse audit outcomes where there wasn't sufficient revenue to cover the expenditure. So it has, so there's appreciation that it has to happen before year end in terms of addressing that, that specific issue. And then some of the comments, I think it's comments that we noted in terms of the discussion and strengthening the equitable approach around allocation of the grants and how the medium term and long term funding actually look like for the sector. So we'll definitely take that up as we discuss with the various technical teams in the municipal sector as well as the other spheres of government. And then also, yeah, I think Councillor Baluzi has covered on the municipality as well. Thank you, Chair. I hope I didn't leave anything out.
Thank you very much, Councillor. Although today it is very difficult, the signal is not doing justice to us. But I think maybe others who are in town or in other places, not in the farms where we are, they're able to grasp everything. But having said that, Stephen, I think you are one of the people who want to respond. There are other questions that were directed to Treasury. Stephen and the team from Treasury.
Thank you very much, Chair. It's a pleasure to be with you again. We've been with your members engaging in the various provinces over the last week. I think we've only got KwaZulu-Natal left to engage on the bill. In the interest of time, Chair, I will try and limit myself to just responding where members asked questions that were also addressed in part to the Treasury. So starting with Honourable Ryder's question, there was a question on the possibility of making the local government equitable share formula performance linked. In terms of Section 214 of the Constitution, there's some limits around what can be included in the equitable share formula calculation. And making it performance-based would kind of tread on the bounds of constitutionality there. So that's not something we're looking at. However, on the conditional grant side, it is possible to do performance-based allocation, and we are moving more in that direction. So you'll see every year there's some new grant that includes a performance component. So, for example, the integrated urban development grant.
Stephen, can you switch on your camera for the sake of media and the public, please?
Certainly, Chair. My camera is on. I'm just going to switch it off and switch it on again. can you see me now, I hope? I even wore a tie for the occasion. I think it would be a waste if
it's on, Chair.
It's not working.
It's okay. On.
Okay. At least it seems like signal is now like the weather. You know, some days you have good weather, and some days you have bad weather.
Okay. Thank you.
I think we've addressed the local government equitable share performance link question. From several members and then also from Salga, there were a lot of questions about the size of the allocations in the municipal disaster relief grant. Let me try and explain this as clearly as I can. The limit on the size of the transfers from the Municipal Disaster Relief Grant is that at the moment, we're in May of 2020, and so that's within the new financial year for national government, but the Division of Revenue Bill has not yet been enacted. Obviously, this is a hearing as part of the parliamentary process towards that. What that means is that we don't actually have a legal budget for 2020 yet. So we are working in terms of the provisions from the PFMA and last year's, the 2019 Division of Revenue Act, which allow us to spend up to 45% of last year's allocation. So as a result of that, we are only allowed to spend up to a maximum of 45% of last year's municipal disaster relief grant allocation. That is 151 million rand. So we have transferred or allocated, approved for transfer, that full 151 million rand, so the maximum we can. But that then translates into very small allocations for each individual municipality. That's clearly not a good situation. None of us are happy with that, and I think that's part of why we're encouraging Parliament to pass the Division of Revenue Act as swiftly as possible. That also speaks to the broader pressure about when the allocations announced by the President can be released. Again, we need to pass the 2020 budget so that we can introduce an amendment bill. The President did announce that the Minister will table a special adjustment budget. We need a budget before we can adjust it. I hope that's fairly straightforward. In terms of the other numbers, though, I appreciate that Salga notes on slide 16 the work that's been done to reallocate amounts from other conditional grants in the system. I would just note that almost all of the numbers on slide 16 are either incorrect or out of date. There is a press release that the Treasury issued yesterday, so it's on our website, and I'm sure our parliamentary office would be happy to circulate it to the committees as well, that summarizes the amounts that have already been made available to municipalities in the 2019-20 financial year, and they total more than 5 billion rand. So in terms of the flexibility of the system, we have provided more than 5 billion rands worth of disaster-related funding to municipalities just in the last 3 months of this financial year, the 1920 municipal financial year. So I think that's just important to note. And in terms of, Salga also raised this question of why the municipal disaster relief grant is only about 350 million rand. I think it's also worth noting that this is the first time that the full 350 million rand will be used, right? Disaster funding is not an easy thing because you don't know in advance when a disaster is coming. So the President announced a 20 billion rand package for local government. I don't think any of us would want to cut the local government equitable share and grant by 20 billion and set them aside every year as a kind of just-in-case fund in case there's a disaster of this magnitude. Disasters of this magnitude, I don't know how often, maybe once a century or something, so you can't set aside in advance a huge sum of money for this, I think. In terms of what the municipal disaster relief grant is usually used for, it's to respond to a flood that occurs across maybe one or two municipalities. When we had a large-scale drought, we added additional money outside of that grant. So in those kind of senses, the system is able to respond, and as I noted, we had the flexibility now in the last few months of this financial year to provide 5 billion in support. So the system does have that flexibility. Having said that, we also had already in February acknowledged that the disaster funding system is not ideal. And so you'll see in part 6 of Annexure W1 to the bill where we describe the work we're going to be doing over the next 12 months. On reforms to the Division of Revenue. One of those is to work with the National Disaster Management Center on a review of the disaster funding regime. So that was already work in progress, and I think we're learning a lot of lessons in this as we all become disaster funding experts. I think I can certainly say my time is taken up almost entirely with various approvals for changes relating to the pandemic. Okay, let me move on then. Just on a related question then, Honourable Karim was asking about how we make those funding allocations. I think he was referring to the adjustment budget. and whether we take account of the COVID burden and differences across different municipalities. It's Treasury's practice never to talk to the details of future allocations before those allocations are made. So I shouldn't pretend that the final allocations have been decided yet. So I can't answer exactly, but what I can say related to that is that in terms of the two disaster relief grant tranches that we have made so far, so this 151 million that's been released to municipalities, that did not include any variable around the burden of the disease across different municipalities, because there were small amounts to support general work for sanitization, et cetera, that all municipalities need to do. And then at the end of March, we released 466 million rand to provinces as an initial tranche of funding towards the purchase of personal protective equipment in provinces. And again, those allocations, which are more directly health-related, obviously, were not based on the disease burden across the provinces, simply because the disease, especially at that stage, was, you know, the pattern was changing so fast that it was, you know, and a flare-up could occur potentially in any of the provinces. So all provinces need to be prepared. So I'm not saying that we won't consider the burden of disease across provinces and municipalities in the future round of allocation. But all I can say is at the moment that's one of the things we've sort of discussed, but decided that it wouldn't actually be prudent to use that. Honourable Karim also had a question about the capacity constraints at all levels of government and how we can assist municipalities. I think one of the things that you always find in disaster funding, and this is in disaster management, and this is certainly something we'll discuss with the NDMC as part of the review, is that when a disaster strikes, it's not a time when you can really, you know, start new things and hire new people, etc. You kind of have to respond using the tools that you already have in place and the measures you already have in place, which is why in the Disaster Management Act and elsewhere, there is such a strong emphasis on disaster preparedness, because you're going to find yourself, you know, when the disaster strikes, you can't then start preparing. You have to use what you already had in place. And it's particularly at this time when there are all these travel restrictions, et cetera, it's very difficult to deploy additional capacity to municipalities. So even on accounting things, you know, our MFMA helpline is open and we're responding as quickly as possible to queries. But in the past, we might have been able to deploy consultants to go and assist particular municipalities. That's just physically not possible at the moment. So it does make it difficult, even though, as I say, we are trying to find ways to work around that as far as possible through electronic means, but it is difficult. Just also on the preparedness issue, it is worth noting that the Treasury has always said that municipalities should have cash coverage of 3 months. And part of the reason for that requirement is that is exactly for disaster events, right? If municipalities, for some disastrous reason, cannot collect revenue for a month, they should be able to survive if they, you know, they should be able to manage a severe dip if they adhered to those 3 month requirements. So again, that's a kind of a form of preparedness. There was also a question from Honourable De Toy about the assignment of functions related to the capacity of municipalities. I would also just note here that in the SALGA submission, they talk to the assignment of functions, but also to the delegation of functions, and those are different things. Most of what SALGA is referring to as unfunded mandates are cases in which a province usually has signed a service level agreement with a municipality for them to provide a service on behalf of the province, for example, clinics and libraries are often, library services are often provided by larger cities on behalf of provinces, and there is a payment agreement within that service level agreement that specifies how much the province must pay, and there are always disputes about how much must be paid. It's a pity that Salga didn't raise the fact that in last year's Division of Revenue Act, so in the 2019 Act, we added a new clause that requires that provincial treasuries must make sure that provincial budgets are adequate to cover the terms of those payment agreements that form part of any service level agreement. And so that was in last year's Division of Revenue Act, which means that effectively in the preparation of the 2020 provincial budget, that would have been the first time that clause was enforced. And it would have been interesting to hear from Salga, you know, whether that's made a difference, whether municipalities are using the sort of bargaining power that clause gives them. The Salga suggestion that we could just fund municipalities directly kind of violates the principle of funds following functions. Where the function has not been formally assigned to a municipality, the division of revenue is based on the legally assigned functions to each sphere. So where a function is just delegated to another sphere to perform it on behalf in terms of a service level agreement, we can't change the funding based only on that service level agreement. But if the function is formally legally assigned to another sphere, then there are provisions in the Division of Revenue Bill. You can see them, for example, in the public transport operations grant, where if a bus route is assigned from a province to a municipality, then there are provisions for the funding to go to the municipality instead. So there are a lot of details in the bill that do cover these things, and it's kind of a pity that those weren't engaged with. There was a question from Honourable Mkivu about the need to fund rural transport. I completely agree with that. There is a set of work underway on a transport funding review within the Department of Transport and a transport subsidy policy. There are a lot of cases within the sort of transport funding space where there are anomalies. I mean, the other well-known one perhaps is that we have these extensive bus subsidies and train subsidies, but no operating subsidies for taxis. So all of those issues, rural transport issues, scholar transport issues, are all part of that package of work, and hopefully that will produce some results. And a last comment from me, and there were a lot of questions around the 9%. One comment that I would like to add to the mix there is to think back to when the division of revenue between the three spheres last changed substantially, because it's very difficult to change the division of revenue by reducing allocations to one sphere and increasing allocations to another sphere. You know, that would require us identifying something in national or provinces that is overfunded, and I don't think any of us would seriously suggest that the basic education system is or the health system in provinces is so overfunded that we would want to reduce the funding for that. I don't think any of us would suggest that police or social grants, which are the largest functions in national government, are overfunded. So it becomes very difficult if you're doing it that way. However, there was a period between 2000 and 2010 when the share of the division of revenue allocated to local government increased from 3% to 9%, so a threefold increase in the share. And the key to that period was that was a period when government had rapidly increasing revenue. So as soon as there is increasing revenue, as soon as there is economic growth that generates those kind of increased revenues that we can budget for, then government has shown that we do increase the allocations to local government. So if we can get back to a situation where we have economic growth, where we have growing revenues, then, you know, the share of local government becomes much easier to increase. At the moment, it's just very difficult. You know, we can sort of pound the drum repeatedly about wanting to see a different share for local government, but in the absence absence of additional revenue at national level, it's very difficult to accomplish that none of us, I think, wants to suggest that these very important functions in other spheres are seriously overfunded. Chair, I think I hope I've responded to the issues that were addressed to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. I don't know if I understand why you didn't want to switch on your video. Since I knew you, you always dress professionally. So because of the signal, I'm not sure how you're dressed today. But I'll encourage you all the time to represent Treasury well, because that's one of the things that I appreciate, and it says a lot about an institution and individuals and professionals like you. There's one thing that just a small thing that the Honorable Ryder wanted to make a follow-up on what you were presenting, and after that you will be done. Honorable Ryder.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just wanted to without opening a debate, and I really don't think it's appropriate to open a debate, but I just wanted to challenge Stephen's comment on Section 214 of the Constitution. I think those who are on my committee know I've always got it fairly close to hand, so I had a quick look at it. And I actually believe that 214 actually allows you to look at perhaps linking equitable share to performance, certainly in terms of paragraph 214.2H. Now, when you read that, it talks about the obligations of provinces and municipalities in terms of national legislation. Now, if you read 214.2H in conjunction with Treasury's 216.2, read that together with the cooperative government comments in 41.1C, and read that with the local government requirements and obligations in 152.1A. Stephen, I will send an email with this. But just if you read that, I do believe that there is quite a strong argument to be made for linking the allocations of funds to the fact that people are using the money appropriately and spending it wisely, and in terms of the way that they should be doing. So not opening a debate, just challenging the thoughts, and perhaps opening for further discussions in the future. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ryder, and I think I appreciate what you said, that you will send your comments to Stephen, so that he can check on those clauses that you have mentioned. And now, Honorable Councillors, I think we are done with your slot, and I really want to appreciate and thank you very much for your cooperation and availing yourself. A very important process that we are in terms of public participation. You are a very important stakeholder, because there's no national department without national government without you. There's no provincial government without you. There's no district without you. Everything starts with you. You are the heartbeat of the government or the country. Thank you very, very much. We really appreciate your participation in this process. Having said that, now we'll go to the next item, which is Kosazi. Comrade Matthew.
Hi, Comrade Chairperson.
Okay.
Should I?
You okay?
Yeah, not good. Okay, thanks. Good morning to honorable members and to colleagues and comrades. I think Lubabalo will assist me by managing the PowerPoint presentation. But I think it's good to see Chairperson, to see members are looking well. We hope all members are healthy, the families are safe. It's quite an unusual situation, and I think we appreciate the Select Committee not delaying issues and having public hearings on a virtual platform. I think you are the first committee to do that. So, Comrade Chair, you are making history as a proud daughter of Nahau.
Thank you.
So, Chair, let me also apologize to members if I go slightly out of my colouring book today, and I might raise some issues which are not 100% within the Division of Revenue Bill, but because they are so linked contextually, it's difficult not to just briefly mention them at times. But I think, Chair, let me say firstly as COSATU, and again, it's very difficult, Chair, today because we're dealing with a budget which is, to be honest, has been heavily hit by COVID-19, by the lockdown of the economy, but we'll try to do our best as we can and try to also focus, Chairperson, on proposals on a supplementary budget which we believe should be submitted as quickly as possible to Parliament for adoption. So I think, Chair, let me just start with the context. We were very kind of worried when the budget was tabled at Parliament in February. We didn't feel the budget really addressed the economic crisis, the governance crisis facing us. We then had a 40% unemployment rate. It's probably now pushing towards 50%. We didn't feel the budget addressed that issue. Of course, as you know, members, we have very dangerous levels of inequality and poverty, especially in our rural areas, in our townships and so on. We also felt, Chair, that the budget, the Division Revenue Bill, doesn't speak to the collapse of many of the SOEs, but also the collapse of many municipalities which can no longer pay workers on time. And as you know, some of our departments also now struggle to perform the functions they're required to do so. Chair, I think we're also quite disappointed that we didn't feel, and we all know it, that the budget didn't address the rising levels of corruption and wasteful expenditure across the state, but particularly in provincial departments and municipalities. And of course, we were quite disappointed that there are no new revenue measures in the budget, given that revenue is under severe pressure in the state. And lastly, Chair, before COVID-19, we were in an economic recession. We didn't feel the budget really addressed that crisis. I think next slide, Lubabalo. Chair, I think as COSATU, we had really had hoped to hear clear response from government in the budget and the revenue bill to the economic, the governance, and the budgetary crisis across the state, from national to provincial to local government, to the SOEs. We had really hoped to have a stimulus package, a clear linkage to the jobs and investment commitments from the different summits and plans to implement them, a clear turnaround plan for the economy, but also clear plans to manage the SOEs, not just the national SOEs, but even the provincial municipal SOEs, which we often forget about, but also a clear debt management plan, and of course to expand the Reserve Bank mandate. So we are quite pleased with some of the interventions that the Reserve Bank has made in the past 2 months in the economy, and we hope those will continue, Chair. Our next slide, Lubabalo. Chair, I think right now what we still have these concerns. We think we need to have a bold stimulus plan. The current budget, if it will not help address the rising unemployment levels, it will not even get us out of the economic recession, let alone steer us away from a possible economic depression now with COVID. On the issue of corruption, Chair, we have felt there are very few consequences for managers, for MECs, for councillors, anybody who is looted. Very few people are being prosecuted. We don't see a real sense of action from national, provincial, local government to hold those accountable. We see very little action by the National Prosecuting Authority. Next slide. Chair, our concern about the revenue issue, and we appreciate that you can only increase taxes so far. But in the past 4 years, we felt the taxes that have been increased had largely impacted upon the working and middle classes. For example, the VAT hike, the tax bracket adjustments, but very little tax increases were placed upon the wealthy. Of course, now that's much more difficult with COVID-19, but I'll come back to that in a second. Chair, I think the other issue which of serious concern was in the Division Revenue Bill, which obviously it cascades from the national budget, is a fixation on the Public Service Wage Bill. That seemed to be the only bold proposal by the budget to address the many crises facing the country, and we feel that is the wrong intervention by the national government. Next slide, Lubabalo. So, Chair, some of our budget proposals for a supplementary budget. One, we're glad the President has announced that there will be a supplementary budget tabled as soon as possible. We think that it has to be done quickly. we do appreciate it's quite difficult because we're not out of the lockdown yet, and government, all of us are feeling in the dark to some extent about what is needed, what is the damage, etc. But it would be useful, we think, for Treasury to announce some interim time frame. When will they table that budget? To give a sense of kind of a surety. Chair, I think around the budget, we would need to see a drastic reallocation of funding. For example, cancelling many programs which are simply no longer relevant or a priority, that would range from travel to advertising, but also other programs which might just simply be a luxury at this stage of the crisis. Chair, we would want to see significant funding increase allocated to the Department of Health, the Departments of Basic Education, the Department of Transport, Human Settlements, Water and Sanitation, for obvious reasons, but also other national departments around trade, industry, and labor. We did welcome, Honorable Chair and members, the economic relief measures announced by the President, the 500 billion rand package so far. We feel that's a welcome interim intervention, but we now need to see a bold, aggressive stimulus plan. We don't think it can be less than 1 trillion rand if we hope to have a chance of countering the up to 16% GDP contraction and a potential unemployment rate of 50%. Chair, I think we need to also say that a stimulus plan, it can't be a blank check. That whatever stimulus relief we give to businesses has to be conditional upon them saving jobs. We can't bail out companies simply for them to go and retrench workers the next day. Equally, Chair, we think we need to put more in place to incentivize job creation. We can convert the stimulus loans to companies, to grants, if they can show they've created new jobs. Chair, I think we also need to see a much more coordinated and dedicated support given to heavily affected sectors of the economy, such as retail, hospitality, transport, restaurants, tourism, etc. Many of these companies will not survive, and that's going to hit all of us at all levels of government and society if we don't have a coherent plan around it. The 2.5 billion rand allocated so far will not match the up to 14 billion rand damage a day the economy is experiencing with the shutdown. So we need to see a much more aggressive response there, Chair. I know committee members would obviously ask, well, where will we get the money from? And we appreciate government is going to have to re-look at the deficit and the debt levels, given the crisis. We support that. Chair, we've had extensive engagement with the President of the Republic around tapping into international financial resources. We welcome that. We accept the realities of the need to do so. And we know it is difficult for many of us from the Alliance to accept going to the IMF, but I think we will reassure by the President's commitments about the conditionalities attached, that those will be minimal. They will not undermine our sovereignty as a nation. That also, for example, the IMF interest rates, I think, will be 1%, which is much lower than other existing loans. So I think, Chair, we support tapping into any funding we can get from government, international, etc., as long as they manage the conditionalities, the interest rates charged, and of course the Forex exchange rate balancing as well. Chair, I think also we have to recognize, just to go back to the slide for 1 second, Lupabalo, government on its own cannot pay the entire check. It doesn't have enough resources. It'll never be able to raise enough revenue. We need to have a serious conversation with, and we've been having very positive engagements with the business at NEDLAC on impact investments. Our members should be aware that in Regulation 28, it provides for up to 10% to what they're called alternate investments. We think that those need to be tightly coordinated. We need to prioritize key economic sectors like ports, railways, energy, water, education and health, stuff which will grow the economy, and also see a decent return to investments and so on. And to Chair, we think it can't just simply be left as a overall feel-good commitment by government, by business. We need to set up an impact investment advisory council to help identify priority areas to help make sure business does do the investments and have the necessary impacts that we need to grow the economy and to create jobs. Next slide. Chair, I think, and we recognize that we appreciate what government has done to try to give tax relief across the economy just simply to keep the economy going. They had no choice, we support that. I think going forward, it'll be very difficult to raise new tax measures. But we think there is some space to look at increasing income tax for those who earn above 1.5 million rand or the top two income tax brackets, inheritance taxes. My Chair, I just want also to remind members about the previous commitment by government and by the ruling party, the ANC, in its election manifesto from last year about providing some sort of relief for the VAT tax hike there was a commitment in the ANC manifesto about increasing free electricity and water to indigent households, the registered indigent households. We've not seen that happen yet. Of course, we're not blind to the economic crisis right now. I think, Chair, just kind of lastly on the issue of revenue, we'd want to see much more kind of emphasis on capacitating staff to fill tax loopholes and to tackle customs evasion, illicit trade in tobacco and clothing. Next slide. Chair, around the issue of corruption, maybe I don't need to go on too much about it, but we really struggle to get a sense of what is government's plans to tackle corruption. Provincial departments, municipal government are notorious for massive levels of corruption. We see it every day in the media, but there's very little in the budget or the division revenue about what has been done to recover those stolen funds, who is being held accountable, what additional accountability measures have been put in place, etc. We've seen very, very few arrests, and it's difficult to build confidence of the public that the taxpayers' money is being well spent by provinces, by municipalities, when we see a wild west in many provinces. I think next slide, Chair Lubabalo. Chair, a proposal on for corruption from COSATU's side is to have comprehensive forensic audits of all SOEs, provincial and local government. But Chair, not just to have those audits, but also to make sure they are enforced. We were quite shocked to hear that ESCOM has had about 3,000 audits, but they've not been implemented yet. We think we need to see lifetime audits of elected leaders, not just nationally, but also provincially and locally, but even going further to have lifestyle audits of management and supply chain officials. We would want to see, Chair, the role of the Chief Procurement Officer, Office of National Treasury, being expanded to see where, as much as possible, they can centralize procurement, or at least to help reduce corruption and costs. But I think, Chair, I mean, given the levels of corruption in provincial and local government, we'd want to see Treasury officials having a much stronger role in oversight over those departments and municipalities, including deploying officials to the supply chain units of provincial and local government and the SOEs. Next slide. Chair, I think as COSATU, we are willing to engage with government on ways we think we can help address many issues in the budget. We'd want to see the public procurement bill being fast-tracked by Treasury, and that it is not just a national bill, but also is binding upon provincial and local government, and key to it must be the issue of local procurement. I think we'd want to see much more efforts around reducing wasteful expenditure in provincial and local government. Maybe one positive thing about the shutdown is that no one is traveling overseas right now, but there are still, we think, significant areas of threat in municipalities and provincial government. And one example, Chair, is the Chuane Municipal head office, which cost about 2 billion rand to set up. There's about another 5 other head offices costing similar amounts. Next slide, Chair. Chair, I think around the public service wage bill, and of course that's quite a critical issue around the division of revenue allocations, we are hoping now with the shutdown with COVID-19 that colleagues will now see the need to capacitate the state and the dangers of decapacitating or underfunding the public service. We feel the wage bill is stable at 35% for the past decade. It's in line with international norms. And in fact, Chair, we're now seeing the dangers of allowing the headcount to continue decreasing as it is by about 1% per annum. Chair, often there's been issues about the headcount public service, but in fact, the headcount has actually been stable at about 1.1 million for the past 10 years. And in fact, in 1994, when we had about 60% of the current population we have today, the public service was about 1 million. Chair, I think we need to see in provincial government departments a review of the filling of critical service vacancies and to prioritize filling those posts in health and education. Next slide. Chair, I think just simply on the wage bill, we'd want to propose that government honor the existing 2020 wage agreement, conclude that matter the Public Service Bargaining Council where it's under mediation right now, and allow those public servants to focus on their job as essential workers in this crisis right now. But there is space, Chair, we think, to reduce the salaries and the perks we give provincial cabinets, mayoral committees, the entities across the provinces and municipalities, and efforts to reduce the wage gap, et cetera. And of course, Chair, there's quite a few reports we've received about ghost posts, especially in provinces like Northwest and Eastern Cape, which we think government needs to tackle more urgently. Next slide. Chair, I think let me leave the wage bill as it is now. Next slide. Chair, just in terms of some of the specific departments, so forgive me for including DTI and the Department of Labor. Those are national departments. They're not relevant to this bill. But I think, Chair, we would want to say, for obvious reasons, we think there's a need to significantly beef up the allocation to DTI if we're going to grow the economy, and specifically to fund more significantly its industrialization programs and its 14 sectoral master plans, if they're to help grow the economy. This obviously has an impact upon provincial economies. Chair, we're talking about ensuring health and safety plans across the economy, across departments, municipalities. The Department of Labor then needs to be capacitated sufficiently. Right now, it's got about 1,400 labor inspectors and about 400 health and safety inspectors. Essentially, Chair, that means that each labor inspector is responsible for 1,000 places of employment in the country. That would take them 3 years to visit every single place of work if they did one every single day. So we're going to have to significantly increase the inspectors that government has if you want to enforce the new health and safety requirements. Next slide. Chair, I think the most critical department right now, which needs a significant boosting in the supplementary budget, is the health department, for obvious reasons. We're worried that in the existing February budget, there looks like a delay or further postponement of NHI implementation targets. In fact, we need to fast track those targets. And we can see now the strain of underfunding the Department of Health in terms of management crises, understaffing, where some hospitals you have one nurse performing the jobs of six nurses. You have doctors working 48-hour shifts. We simply cannot continue like that. We really need to see in the supplementary budget a significant reinforcing provincial and local health infrastructure, and to appoint on a full-time basis those community health workers. We welcome the 28,000 health workers, but they need to be made permanent and given the proper resources and training. Chair, there's also going to be a need to appoint transport health inspectors now as well to help enforce those safety plans for taxis or buses and our trains. Next slide. Chair, basic education, as members would know, is in a huge crisis. There is no clear plan when the schools will reopen, and critical to that is the lack of a health and safety plan. Chair, one of our frustrating issues around the existing budget and all the previous budgets is that we never have a clear time frame. When are we going to eradicate the sanitation crisis in our schools? Every year we kick the can down the road. We don't get a clear time frame. When are we going to finally eradicate it? And now we're paying the price of it. It's going to be very difficult to enforce health and safety plans for a school in rural Limpopo if they have bucket toilets. It's going to be impossible. Chair, I think we need to see in the new budget a serious resourcing for the Department of Education around PPEs for teachers and learners, the social distancing measures and shift systems, including the glass or plastic screens for desks. And this will require us to reprioritize the curriculum and the calendar and which grades go back to school first. But also, Chair, I think we need to see not just the private schools and well-off universities being able to do online learning, but also our township schools, which requires investing in those schools in a significant way. And then lastly, around education, Chairs, around what are we doing about safe scholar transport? Next slide, Lubabala. Chair, around transport, we've had extensive meetings at NEDLAC members around the health and safety measures to make sure that the taxis, the buses, and the trains implement the national guidelines, but there's no health inspectors to enforce it. So it's going to be very, very difficult to police it. We don't get a sense from the taxis and the trains about a program to test the drivers, to screen passengers. We met with Santaco's leadership on Monday, and they raised concerns with us about they don't have enough temperature scanners to screen passengers coming to the taxis. So I think those are huge crises, Chair. You will see, Chair, that Gautrain is reopened now under level 4, but Metro Rail can't reopen because they don't have a health and safety plan. Again, Chair, that's going to have huge impacts upon provincial economies. I think, Chair, as the previous colleagues had mentioned from government, we need to see a much more decisive investment in public transport. It might need to see now an increase in subsidies for taxis if we're going to enforce the social distancing and lower passenger volumes in the taxis. And then, of course, Chair, to finally say goodbye to the e-tolls, which seemingly it's extended, it's not extended. We're not sure what the situation is. Next slide. Then, Chair, around local government, I think first of all, one frustration point about the Division of Revenue Bill is that we don't get a sense of a response from government to the collapse of good governance in many municipalities. Two-thirds of municipalities in the Northwest Province are under administration. but the bill doesn't speak to what has been done there. Doesn't speak to what's been done to overhaul procurement processes where the corruption is based. We've got about 27 municipalities before the shutdown which are no longer able to pay staff on a timeless basis, especially in the Free State and the Northwest provinces, but also Limpopo as well. Chair, we were quite surprised in the Division of Revenue Bill how some of the expanded public works and community works programs are basically a form of cheap labor. We had agreed with certain terms of reference with the Department of Public Works nationally that these programs cannot be a source of cheap labor for municipalities, cannot replace permanent municipal jobs, like cleaning of municipal buildings, for example. Yet the programs in the Division of Revenue Bill speak exactly to that, that it will clean municipal buildings. So, Chair, we think government has to intervene on this issue. It should be for new jobs and new economic sectors. It should not be doing permanent municipal work. I think lastly, Chair, I think we would all agree with the honourable members in the earlier discussion about a new funding model for municipalities. Government has been speaking significantly about a new district model. We think we need to now implement that in a rapid basis. Most of these municipalities are not financially viable. They don't have a sufficient rate base, and we need to really see how can we consolidate them and properly capacitate them. Next slide. Chair, I think around public works, we really want to see a much clearer health and safety plan in the supplementary budget to ensuring health and safety enforcement at schools and buildings. In particular, Chair, I think we need to see forensic audits of the public works buildings because that's where you get many of the allegations of corruption, especially in provinces like Northern Cape. Then lastly, Chair, on agriculture and land reform, rural development. Again, Chair, we can't explain why we are underfunding this department. It's a critical economic growth department, but the amount of resources we allocate there is similar to what we allocate for bodyguards and politicians. The amount allocated in the Division of Revenue Bill, Chair, would mean that we'll never be able to address the land restitution, the land claims backlog, or look at expanding land rehabilitation programs, etc., Chair. Next slide. So, yeah, my last slide, Comrade Chair, and apologies for taking so long. We all know that the Department of Water and Sanitation collapsed about a year, 2 years ago. We don't see much of a response in the Revenue Bill. What has been done to rebuild that department? What has been done to capacitate municipalities to deal with the water crisis plans? And again, Chair, around the bucket toilets, we don't get a coherent plan about eradicating the bucket toilets. And again, with COVID-19, that is a critical health risk in informal areas. Lastly, Chair, I think for social development, we welcome the social grant increases announced by the President. These are very progressive. But I think we're going to need to see a significant investment in SASA and the department to modernize the systems, to avoid the continuous complaints of people struggling to apply and to receive the payments. And I think, Chair, maybe going forward, lastly, we now need to revive the discussion about a basic income grant. We see even our Treasury supporting that, which is quite a welcome shift. And the very last point, Chair, was about we have a huge problem of substance abuse amongst young people, especially in the urban areas, but the amounts allocated to the Departments of Social Development for that, we feel are far too little to enable government to tackle drug abuse significantly. So let me stop there, Chair. I hope the sound quality was decent and I didn't take too much of members' time. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Matthew. Members have been waiting for your indication or registration that you want to speak. So far, I have received the indication from Honorable Ryder. So while Honorable Ryder is making a contribution, can you please indicate whoever wants to engage on the presentation. Thank you, Honorable Comrade Matthew. Honorable Ryder.
Thank you. Back on a fairly unstable internet connection, so that I hope that I'm audible. And of course, noting that I now have got about an hour to talk, if someone else wants to talk, I'm sad that I don't have a lot to contribute on this discussion. Because, yeah, the presentation, I worked through it quickly this morning, but having received it only so late last night, anyway, let's not get into that.
Chair, I really only have one question, and I think the obvious issue was mentioned by Mr. Parks. It relates to the public sector wage bill. Now, COSATU has been trying to hold government to the terms of a three-year-old agreement that was signed by a different administration in an economic climate that was already vastly different to the prevailing economic climate that we had before COVID-19 struck. Now, with the impact of COVID-19, the urgent need of government to reprioritize funding to find 500 billion rand straight away, but the cost is probably going to be closer to 1.5 trillion rand, to get this country back on track. The fact that COSATU remains trying to keep the terms of that agreement on the table is at least at the very best questionable to me. The climate has changed entirely. 3 years ago, we were in a different South Africa totally from what we're in today. I believe it's actually disingenuous to keep to the terms of that. And my question to Mr. Parks is COSATU willing to renegotiate the terms in any way? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Detroit.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm actually not supposed to be shocked, but I am shocked with some of the utterances of COSATU, specifically then focusing on requesting more inspectors and officials to be appointed to basically police employers. COSATU emphasized the fact that we're currently sitting with a high unemployment rate and an unemployment rate that will be rising as we move further into this COVID-19 situation. I'd rather make a suggestion. If COSATU is so serious about unemployment and the protection of jobs, why don't they rather place the emphasis on assistance to be given to all employers and businesses, irrespective of race and ethnicity, to ensure that job security is kept in the country and job losses is prevented? That is my 2 cents. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Tutuit. Honourable Njandu. Honourable Njandu, you are next. Okay, Honourable Karim. I think maybe still struggling to connect.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is to welcome presentation of COSATU, Chair. Thank you very much. Mine is in terms of a comment to the consideration of the presentation around the focus areas in the crisis, which is where the budget needs to be focused on in terms of health, education, and also on COVID governance areas that need to be addressed during this crisis, and also job creation. So, Chairperson, my point is to welcome the presentation, and also to make sure that within this submission that we look in terms of those areas in terms of job creation and economic growth. Thank you very much.
Honourable Karen, thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Just briefly, I broadly agree with what COSATU is saying, but I just want to ask whether COSATU shouldn't be more, let's say, prioritize more clearly what it is they feel, especially when it comes to the supplementary budget, should be done. Because there's no, costing. In other words, there's no clarity what the sources of the funds would be. It's a long list of demands, most of which I would agree with. But now, where would we get the money from? Now, it's not the responsibility of COSAL to any public stakeholder to actually, they don't have the resources that Treasury has to do the costing and to be clear, absolutely clear at least, about the sources of the funding. But they, you know, it becomes too much what COSAT was asking, and so maybe a need for prioritization, a clearer set of priorities. Secondly, now, one can't be fundamentalist about the IMF, obviously. In a situation like this, it would be foolhardy to insist for ideological reasons that we don't go to the IMF. So, you know, one has to assess the situation on specific merits, and there's no, like, ideological dogmatism here. But the question that does arise, and I'm interested in Kosato will respond to this, is the issue is not so much whether one goes to the IMF or not, but the dollar-denominated nature of the loan. So the percentage, maybe 1% interest, and hopefully there'll be no conditionalities, but if the rand continues to slide, and if the past performance, pre-COVID-19 performance of our economies doesn't go by, the prospects are that the dollar-rand exchange rate will be very unfavorable to us. So the issue is the consequences of paying back in dollars to a rand. That's something we need to give careful consideration to. And related to this matter of the IMF, I think what Parliament's asking for, and I presume COSATU is too, is openness and transparency for government. So, you know, Comrade Chair, one's not like stuck in some ideological hole. One is saying that A, it's dollar denominated, so it's huge implication. B, have we exhausted all sorts of local rand denominated funding? Three, we need to know. Parliament needs to know. The public needs to know exactly what those conditionalities are. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Karim. I was intending to break the record and not engage in the presentation for COSATU, because what I have seen, what I've gone through, I'm comfortable with it so far to a certain extent. But without really being being a shop steward again or a chief negotiator again or whatever, a leader, I just want to share with Honorable Dutoy the experience in a sisterly, brotherly way that one was part of this three-year argument. And if you can know that how difficult it was to convince members to agree to a three-year argument, it was difficult because members wanted year in, year out agreement. But the government of the day felt it was not going to help them, and if we have a three-year agreement, it's going to save them to have disruptions on a yearly basis. But having said that, I just want us to play safe and not reopen and take over the work of the TFCDC, where either the amendment or the cancellation or the changing of the three-year agreement is going to be discussed and agreed on, because that's where the agreement was done and that's where it needs to be changed. For us as the community, we can't change it, we can't influence it, and there's nothing we can do. Let the PFCPC deal with the matter and not take over from the employer-employee engagement and get into the space where we don't belong. That's all what I want to comment on for today. Comrade May no response on clarify issues that has been reported to you.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thanks to the honourable members for the questions, which are quite helpful. And so I think to honourable Ryder, look, the issue of the wage bill, the Chair is right. I mean, it belongs to the Public Service Bargaining Council, but we do know it's a key issue for the budget, and so members would obviously, as public representatives, be quite keen to engage and discuss it. I think one of our difficulties as Labour, not just as COSATU, but as also even other federations like FEDUSA, which also organizes in the public service, is how government approached the wage negotiations for this year. We had an existing legally binding agreement. Government did not come to us, say, for example, in October last year after the medium-term budget policy statement. Instead, they had some kind of thing to us in late December, January, we need to talk, but they didn't put any offers on the table. And then what happened the day before the budget speech in February was that the government then tabled formally at the Public Service Bargaining Council its desire to withdraw from the existing agreement. It really put the unions in a difficult spot because we're now basically at 5 minutes to midnight told we're withdrawing from the agreement. No alternative proposal was put on the table. And then the Minister of Finance goes to the budget speech and says, well, we have to reduce the wage bill. It's the cause of all our crises of the government and the economy, etc. So that really poisoned the water significantly. So to be honest, Chair, I think if government had come in October and said, we're in this crisis, we need to see how can we address issues, I suspect we would have been easily able to find each other. But look, I think, Chair, we're not blind to the crisis facing the state. In fact, workers are very much aware of it. And we're also very much aware that if we don't manage the state finances properly, it'll be workers who will pay the consequence in the forms of retrenchments, wages being cut, public service delivery collapsing, etc. But I think, Chair, it'll be very difficult to sell an agreement to walk away from the existing agreement to workers. Workers feel that means they're also in a green light to any employer to simply walk away from whatever agreement they've agreed to. But there is a keenness from our side to help government address the 160 billion rand target if needs to be through the next 3-year wage agreement. And we've done some costing. We think that's easily doable in the next 3-year agreement. We can do those savings. Remember one thing, Chair, that the inflation levels have plummeted significantly. So the previous inflation level target or guesstimate of 5.5% fell to 4.5. It's now 3.8% and is likely to decrease further. But Chair, we think also you can do a sliding scale increase for the next 3 years. You can assure the working and middle class elements of the public service, levels 1 to 8 to 12, of a CPI plus 1 or a CPI increase. And then you can see management either getting CPI minus 2 or even a freezing increase. But I think, Chair, that the other proposal we've been making around the wage bill for members' benefit is we think we need to have a single wage negotiation process for national and provincial government, but also the SOEs. The real fat in the wage bill you find, Chair, is at a management level in the SOEs. So you have a CEO of Genie Water Board earning R1 million every month. You have 800 managers at Eskom earning above R2 million. So it's very difficult to tell a nurse who now is working 18-hour shifts, risking her life combating COVID-19, being a single parent, and she earns about 240,000 rand a year, that she earns too much and she's a problem. When they see management, which is the one which has been looting and mismanaging the state, not being touched. I think that's the one kind of concern. I think, Chair, also, we've seen now the importance of having a capacitated developmental state in this crisis. Governors had to quickly go and hire health workers to try to deal with the screening and the testing, etc. You're seeing nurses and doctors collapsing out of exhaustion. So this is really why we need to see a properly capacitated state. And to be honest, it's difficult to motivate a teacher or a nurse or a police officer if they're being paid very little money and they're struggling to feed their family, take care of their children. But actually, look, I think we will manage to find each other. But I think a future government needs to approach engagements in a much more strategic, considerate manner as opposed to what happened this year. But we're not blind to the crisis. We must find each other. We're all in the same boat together. But it's a question of being able to talk to each other. But we think we can do it in the next 3 years, agreement. Chair, I think to Honourable Dutoy, look, there's nothing which scares workers more than unemployment. The fact we had 40% of rising levels of unemployment Even public servants and SOE workers are now facing the brunt of retrenchments. Many SOEs have been retrenching workers. You would have seen recently Transnet, which employs about 50,000 workers, said they also want to retrench. SAA and SA Express staff have not received salaries for about since February, March. So we're quite keen to address the issue. I think, Chair, to Honourable Dutoy, our number one crisis is unemployment. If we can resolve unemployment, we can create jobs, all the other crises will start to resolve themselves. But Chair, it's very difficult right now to motivate workers to go to work when they fear for their lives. So the supermarket retailers have been working throughout this period. And if you look at who is being affected right now by COVID-19, it's overwhelmingly essential workers. There's about 60 staff members at correctional services who have been infected because there is no health and safety plan in correctional services. Countless pick and pay, ShopRite checkers, Woolworths cashiers have been infected left and right. So I think, Chair, that we really need to find a way to address those issues, and that's why we're quite keen to see health inspectors being employed. It's fine to ask police officers now to police taxi ranks to make sure they've got their PPEs, etc., but those are not health and safety trained personnel. We have to start dealing with this issue quite soon, but I think we can do it with having one inspector for 1,000 places of work. We'll never be able to do justice to it. Chair, for Honourable Njadu, no, I think thank you to Honourable Njadu, and we would agree 100%. We have to resolve our unemployment issue. We have to find ways to grow the economy. That's how we're going to resolve all our governance crises. to Honourable Karim, look, on the issue of the IMF, I would agree with him. We would agree with him 100%. It's not an easy issue. We have quite a few engagements, very robust engagements, as COSATU with alliance partners, with the president. But we agreed, we need to tap into all the funding we can get right now. If we're wanting to come with a stimulus plan to combat the impact of the shutdown on the economy and the GDP contraction and rising levels of unemployment. So I think for us, we said, look, let's compare apples with apples. What is the interest rate being charged? The 1% for the IMF is very attractive. We've been assured by the president that there are no conditions attached to the IMF funding, which will undermine our sovereignty. But I would agree with Comrade Honourable Karim completely. We must balance the issue of having too much debt in dollars, because as Karim is saying, that it might come back to bite us later. I think, Chair, for us, the real sources of revenue has to be domestic investment. We have to unlock impact investments, or what used to be called prescribed assets, in a rapid way. And it has to be very tightly coordinated, going to precise sectors of the economy, but it has to now happen. And I think we've been quite motivated by our engagements with Bursa and NEDLAC on this issue. But I think now it's the question of making sure it happens between government, between business, and it does so in a useful way, because government will never have the revenue to address these crises. If you have a road maintenance backlog of about 600 billion rand, it means government will never be able to address it in our lifetime. But I agree with Honourable Karim. It will really help government a lot to build trust by engaging in this process of the IMF and other lenders in an open and transparent measure to give a sense of rebuilding trust to the state. I think that'll really help us. The last issue from Honourable Karim, Chair. Yeah, look, it's difficult. I mean, we struggled a bit even to present to deliver our presentation for the committee today because there are so many issues because we're dealing with so many crises at once. I think we'd want to see a supplementary budget tabled to Parliament within the next month at the latest. It has to significantly prioritize the critical departments like health, basic education, transport, labor, DTI, housing and sanitation for obvious reasons. And a lot of it is going to have to come from reprioritizing brutally other departments' expenditures. Other departments will have to let go of some of the vanity projects or non-essential projects. It will mean that we're going to, where we've already exceeded the 70% deficit issue, GDP debt issue. But again, Chair, the real solution is the impact investments, because government will never have enough funds to tackle all these issues. But I think lastly, Chair, is that whatever money we allocate to government or we generate, if government doesn't tackle the issue of corruption and wasteful expenditure, we are just moving in circles. We can't, as the Auditor General says, lose about 10% of our budget every year to corruption, wasteful expenditure, and yet plead poverty due to revenue shortfalls. We have to deal with those issues, especially in municipalities and provinces and SOEs, and our investments have to be linked to job creation, Chair. That is partly why we had said in in immediate responses to the COVID-19. Let us release money from the UF to help workers. So 40 billion rand, which is about a quarter of the UF's funding, has been released just to assist companies and workers right now to survive, to remain employed, to keep those businesses afloat so they can, workers don't lose their jobs. But he've also said, let's have engagement with the TIC around how can we invest in the economy in ways which create jobs, which save businesses. And I think, sorry, lastly, I didn't mention to respond to Toy, we're supporting economic relief measures to all companies. We've seen the debates with the Department of Tourism and Small Business Development. We appreciate how little money they've got allocated right now to help companies. It is not enough. It needs to be significantly ramped up. But Chair, I think for us right now, it's about saving every single job, saving every sector of the economy and every single company. We really don't want to be having ideological debates right now, as some of our comments have been doing, because for us, Chair, we have to save every single job in South Africa, bottom line. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Comrade Matthew, for the responses, and thanks members for those questions. I think we are done with the COSATU. We have asked our questions and we are clarified. We now go to the next item. The next item, honorable members, we have two types of this important process, which is public participation. We first dealt with the verbal presentations, but we have received some written submissions. We have, I think I have to declare to say, after we have received the few submissions, we have consulted with our usual stakeholders to say, to invite them to come for verbal presentation, and they said they are comfortable with the written submission. So the written submissions were summarized by the Secretariat and sent to members, and I said they must request members to ask questions or clarities so that we can send them back to them and let them respond, because they are not here and we cannot be able to answer or clarify what is their thinking in terms of their presentation. So the secretary is going to make, the committee secretary is going to make a presentation on the summary of the written submissions. And our focus must be on the responses. If you have make follow-ups or send clarity seeking questions. Thank you, honorable members. Lubabalo? We can't hear you. Lubabalo?
Hello, Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we, like we have indicated, we have received a number of written submissions which we shared with members, and also then we then summarized them. In total, in terms of the submissions that we received, excluding COSATU, we received firstly 9 written submissions, and then post the closing date for the written submissions, we also received 3 more submissions. So I'm going to go through them one by one, Chairperson. I'm not sure, Chair, if my screen is visible to all members and colleagues who are present in the meeting.
Yes, we can see it.
Okay, thanks, Chair. The first written submission, Chairperson, we received from Mr. Borrell. In summary, the submission says that a portion of the provincial and local government allocation should be held back and paid over to Eskom and water supply boards to offset arrears owed to these entities. Second submission was from Mr. Buthelezi. He states that money causes conflict and inequality, and therefore we should revert to the barter system as a means of transacting. Secondly, he said land should be returned to its rightful owners. That submission we received from Mr. Malcolm, he states that this type of legislation reduces transparency with regard to how the government utilizes taxpayers' money. The bill is intentionally complicated, further empowering state organs to change how taxpayers' funds can be used. It reduces efficiency, increases costs, and waste money. Legislation like this encourages and enhances corruption, and this should be stopped. The fourth submission, written submission that we received, Chairperson and honorable members, is from Mr. Polske. The bill, he says that the bill proposes to allocate 500 billion. He suggests that an immediate solution for a long-term solution to eradicate poverty and hunger, 1 million should be allocated to each of the 600 million citizens of the country, which can be disbursed via debit card. No cash withdrawal will be allowed. The money is intended for essentials, such as food and education. Therefore, no need for grants. That leaves the state with 440 billion to plug health care and what is needed other than the pockets of officials. The next submission that we received is from Ms. Prefetcher. She states that, she indicated that she does not support the Division of Revenue Bill. Ms. Tolo states that the bill endangers species on the list, and that is the heritage of our children. The bill smacks of money-making greed to export our wildlife for money. The next submission that we received is from Ms. Van Beek, which she makes similar submissions together with Ms. Tolo. Says that the bill endangers, maybe let me not repeat because the chairperson is the same submission and it's visible. The next submission that we received is Mr. Volk's chairperson. She says that he is concerned about entrusting more funds to local authorities, given that they do not prevent funds from being stolen. Then, let me skip Kosati Chairperson because Mr. Matthew has made the submission in person. The next submission that we received is from Equal Education. Equal Education states that they have consistently raised the issue of low growth in the education budget over the past couple of years. Yet, an actual real decrease is realized due to the budgetary cuts in the 2020 budget. The emergence of coronavirus has eliminated the backlogs that still exist in school, and a shrinking budget will make it even harder for the government to ensure that it will be safe for teachers and learners to return to school. The consequences of the cut to the education budget are felt across various education priorities. It includes cuts to the school infrastructure grants, the school nutrition program, and the National Department of Basic Education second chance program that supports learners to pass their matric exams. Further, Equal Education states that they are concerned that allocation towards the sector, including the National Department of Basic Education, are not keeping up with inflation. That is, it does not accommodate the rising cost of basic services, such as providing safe and adequate school infrastructure or ensuring scholar transport for all learners who need it. Further, they state that the state of school infrastructure in South Africa continues to be a challenge for the basic education sector and a threat to the thousands of learners and teachers across the country. While there has been an improvement in the delivery of school infrastructure, this has unfortunately not been an acceptable pace. The 2020 budget presents plans to ramp up infrastructure and sanitation delivery to schools over the next 3 years. Yet, the school infrastructure backlog grant allocation for the 2021-22 financial year will be less than the amount allocated to the program 3 years ago. These budget reductions undoubtedly affect the government's ability to deliver school infrastructure. Equal Education calls on National Treasury not to reduce the allocation for school infrastructure, as this would be a disservice to learners and teachers in under-resourced public schools across the country. I think, Chairperson, that's all. If I may, Chairperson, through your permission, I would like to table the submissions that you received further that we have not summarized. They are few, Chairperson, and also they are not long. The other submission that we received post the closing date, we received from Sally Goodwin. Sally states that, no, I do not support the division of revenue. The next submission is from Venita Kruger. She states that, no, I do not support the division of revenue bill. More corruption will happen and there will be no transparency, and stop all the new rules and just be transparent. The next submission is from the last one, Chairperson, from Lorraine Parker. She states that, no, I do not support the division of revenue bill. That is all, Chairperson, from our side. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Lubabalo. Those are the submissions that we have received, tried to summarize. And I think these are for noting. And maybe I will suggest that when we deal with the report, members will be allowed to go back to what was presented to us if they feel they must find space in the report to the House. But I'm not going to stop you members from commenting on these proposals, I mean on these presentations. Estelle, do we have anybody who wants to speak?
No, Chairperson, no indication from on my side. Dennis Ryder, sorry, yes, Mr. It looks like Mr. Ryder. DR.
Okay, Honourable Ryder.
Chair, yes, thank you. I think the presentation submitted are all noted. Unfortunately, most of them are quite brief. I think it's a Mr. Malcolm that says that the bill itself is extremely complex. Well, I certainly agree with him. And unfortunately, he doesn't offer an alternative. And the reality is that the bill is complex because it's dealing with a very complex and large issue. So I do believe that the comments are all noted. I think we, as a committee, will note them. We'll take them into account, and I think certainly in our report we can comment on each one. I don't think it's necessary to delve into the depths of each one. We don't have an opportunity to interrogate some of the comments. There's one gentleman whose mathematics seems to be quite far off, but the rest I think all accepted. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Dennis. Honourable Ryder. Yeah, very correct. We understand that the participants or the stakeholders are saying, or the public, they don't agree. They criticize, but they don't give us an alternative so that we can debate on the alternative. I understand what you're saying. Anyone who wants to comment? There's a proposal from Honourable Ryder that we note the presentations or the submissions. Members? Honourable members?
I agree, Chair.
Agree.
Agreed. Thank you very much, Honorable Members. We are
agreed.
Okay, we thank you. We
have
noted. Yes, thank you. You can switch off your mics now. In the agenda that you have been sent, Honorable Members, the last item is the consideration of the minutes. I have requested the Secretariat to send you minutes as usual and request that members, if they want to make amendments or have proposals, they must do those proposals through the Secretariat before we come to the meeting so that we don't debate the minutes in the meetings unnecessarily. We can only debate if there's a need. So we have 5 sets of meetings, and I think we will not be doing justice if we don't adopt these meetings, I mean these minutes, because we have the minutes of the 5th of December, 19th February, 3rd March, 22nd April, and 27th February. Can we start with those, with the 5th of December, Honorable Members? Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. That was the last page. Can I get a mover for the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection of the discussion of the day? Can I get a mover?
Chair, I move for the adoption.
Thank you, Honorable Fanny. Seconda. Seconda.
Chairperson, I've seconded in the meeting chat.
Thank you.
I've seconded, Eunice.
19 February, page 1, 2020. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. And the last page is 5. Can I get a mover?
Honorable Njadu, I move in chair.
Who's that, Njadu?
Njadu, yes, I move in.
Thank you. The seconder?
Sorry, Chairperson, Mr. Karim seconded in the meeting chat.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. The 3rd of March, 2020, page 1. Page 2, page 3, page 4, and last page is 5. As a mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 3rd of March, a mover.
Let me move.
Who's moving?
Zonani Mkiva here.
Mkiva is moving, seconding.
Njadu is seconding.
I've seconded in the chat, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you,
Eunice. Sorry, Chair. I think you accidentally skipped the minutes of the 27th February, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm still coming on them.
I'm still coming,
sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
22nd April 2020. Page 1, page 2, page 3, page 4, page 5, page 6, page 7, page 8, page 9, page 10, page 11, And last page 12. A mover, please. A mover for the adoption of the minutes of
Chairperson, Eunice, I move.
I'm moving.
Eunice moves.
I'm moving, Chair Njandu.
Njandu, second. Thank you.
Njandu, second.
Thank you, second. 27 February 2020, page 1, page 2, page 3, page 4, page 5, page 6, and the last page is 7. Can I formally get a mover for the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection of the discussion of the day?
Move what is adopt.
Siyabulela. Honorable Kiva. Seconder. Honorable Ryder, you were in the meeting.
I think we're going to need a new mover, Chair. Honorable Mkiva submitted an apology.
I'm seconding.
Oh, you must move him. They said he was not there.
Jadu's
moving. A seconder? Can we get a seconder, honorable members, last set of our meeting?
You were clearly hoping I would second them, so I will accede to your request and gladly second them.
That's it. Thank you, Honorable Ryder. We are done with our minutes, and I want to take this opportunity, members, to thank you all. Thank you for your presence, for your understanding when we cut and chop our programs, and really your cooperation is appreciated very highly. I also want to thank very much the support staff, because without them, it wouldn't be easy, and they have an understanding when we request them to go an extra mile to do what they are supposed to do. We only hope that the management of Parliament, as we raised it yesterday in the meeting of the Joint Committee of Management of Parliament Finance, that the support staff needs to be given enough to tools of trade, because it makes their life very difficult, and we expect more from them. And we also expect them to work abnormal hours. They don't work 8 hours, as is in the conditions of Employment Act and Labor Relations Act. So I also want to thank the stakeholders who were here. But lastly, honorable members, let me highlight this. I know some of the members who are the whips and the chairs from different parties will be part of the discussions on Thursday. But I feel it's important that I share with you that I have received a letter through the chairperson of the NCOP from the Minister of Treasury, that he requests that we fast track and amend our programs, that we finish with the appropriations bill by the end of this month, both Division of Revenue and Appropriation by this month. I have made consultations legally and engaged some of the leadership in Parliament. But also, I thought we have gone too far in terms of Division of Revenue. There was no way that we are going to cut corners because we are regulated. If we are to cut these processes of public hearings and stuff, we will be finding ourselves in a problem as a committee. So I have indicated that we will not be able to change anything in as far as the division of revenue is concerned. I also consulted the standing committee chairperson, Honorable Buthelezi, in terms of their programs, that when they have briefings or when there is a day for briefings, for example, briefing by Treasury, we join them or they join us, we have a joint meeting where we have the same briefing, because it might be difficult to have the minister or the ministry and the DG or whoever in both meetings different dates. So where possible, we are going to join, we are going to have joint meetings with the standing committee on appropriations so that we can fast track. Well, but then we have proposed that when we looked in our program, we might be able to end by the 9th, to finish by the 9th, the process of division of revenue. It's still a proposal because NA, they have not finalized yet, and we can't do it before they finalize it. So we might be able to get the answer on Thursday as to when are they going to are they going to finalize the process of division of revenue, and after that we will redo our program and send to members a new program. Any comments from members? That was the last item. Members?
Chairperson, it's Dennis Trider. Sorry, I have put in the comments that I'd like to comment, but my concern with the joint meetings, and I think it's valid, and I'm in agreement with the majority of what you've said. My only concern with the joint meetings is the allocation of time to members. Obviously, with a joint meeting, we are double the number of members, and unfortunately, with the bandwidth issues that Parliament has told us about, we are restricted in terms of the amount of time that we can meet. That dilutes the ability of members to do what they're supposed to do, to ask the appropriate questions. If we can have reasonable agreement that we will be afforded a fair opportunity, and again, within reason, I don't expect to be given an hour-long platform to stand and make a speech, but just to have a fair chance to answer questions that I need. In that case, then certainly I would be agreeable to the joint meetings. The other issue I have, Chairperson, is the request for fair notice. Understanding that division of revenue, when we actually get to a point where we are going to be passing the bill, I don't think there's been a way map forward for exactly how our plenary session will take place. But if we can be given a reasonable amount of notice so that those of us that do intend getting to Cape Town in order to participate in the meeting are unable to do so, obviously taking cognizance of the fact that there are no flights and one would need to either drive down or find some other means of transport to get into Cape Town, because I think that a plenary session over a virtual platform, while it will probably work reasonably well, it may not always work as we've experienced today, where there are technical issues with connectivity specifically. So if we can just be given fair notice if meetings are to be moved around to enable those of us who want to travel to do so. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ryder. The issue of the process of handling the sittings, you will get them after Thursday. I think that's the one of the things that is going to be tabled in terms of the procedure. how are we going to, the budget process, how are we going to deal with each bill. But what you have raised is very important. In our last week meeting of chairs and whips, we have raised the question, but more especially for members of the NCOP, that when we have these meetings, members of the NA are given an opportunity in majority more than the NCOP members. So we also need to be proactive in terms of raising our hands and stuff. But we have raised that question that it needs to be distributed equally so that both houses are represented equally. And thanks for raising those other issues. We will communicate further if there's anything that comes from the meeting that we're going to have, anything new. Anyone else before I close? No one. Honourable members, thank you very much.
It's Lubabalo, Chairperson. I'm sorry for doing this, Chair.
Okay.
Maybe, Chair, you might consider asking colleagues from National Treasury to, like, submit their comments on the written submissions that you tabled before the committee, even if it's in writing, Chairperson, just to hear their side of the story in terms of responding to them.
Responding on what?
On the written submissions, Chairperson. Especially Kosato and
Okay. I think that is agreeable. Treasury, please do that through the Secretariat. I have thanked everybody and keep well, stay home, and only go out when it's necessary. Protect yourself, protect your loved ones, protect your families. And please protect our country and the continent. And so we will be protecting the world. Stay home. Keep healthy. And take care. And may you all be blessed. Thank you so much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Keep well, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Cheers, bye-bye, colleagues.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you all, especially the new Eunice.